Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about the GOP poverty hunt as it continues. More on voting, underwater mortgage solutions. Another interesting JFK theory has recently emerged, one I'm sure that I've never thought of, but you know, we'll talk about that. And also a little bit about transportation, a little about gay marriage, and whatever else pops up throughout the evening. Going to take your calls, your thoughts, your questions, comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. And under the heading of poverty, you know, I go back and I think of all of the things that could be done if the Republicans really wanted, really cared about poverty. And maybe I'm just being cynical. Maybe this is one of those moments of clarity. Maybe Chairman Reed, maybe the Republicans have had a grand epiphany. Maybe someone in their family has fallen into poverty because of the grand. Who knows what the rationale, the reason? Who knows? Maybe they've had a true change of heart. But I look today, back in 1965, if you truly wanted to point to something that helped alleviate poverty, today is the day, back in 1965, that President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Social Security Act of 1965 into law, establishing Medicare and Medicaid. And you think of the millions of people who have been saved from poverty because when they got sick, they didn't go to the streets. To me, that's how you deal with certain types of poverty. You provide a safety net, a line in the sand. You say, you know what? Nobody falls below this. And we make sure that everyone, and this is the call for future generations, to improve upon the 65 law. And for me, as a person who believed in Medicare for all, to expand that so that everyone has that protection. Everyone. But you look at, again, our friends in the GOP, the 40th or the 60th vote to repeal or defund. I'm telling you, it's going to turn around and it's going to bite them. Anyway, today, the big speech. The president was in Chattanooga, Tennessee for the big speech where he called for a grand bargain for the middle class. We need middle class jobs. Where he then went on to lay out part of his plan, which would... I sit here and I go, you know, really? This is what you got? We're going to cut the corporate tax rate. We're going to cut it from 35 down to 28% and give manufacturers a 25% rate. Allow small businesses to write off the first $1 million of investment, which I'm okay, if you got to make a number, why not? He wants Congress to spend some money on infrastructure, which I'm not against. I think it's a great idea. Maybe we should do. He wants to spend some money on community colleges, get people job training, things like that, and put money into investing in manufacturing hubs. Again, not against those ideas. They seem very soft, very tacit in my view. They used to be things that we would all agree on, but the things that interesting to me, repatriating the money. Repatriation was in the speech. Going to have a little transition fee. I can't wait to see how little that is. But reward. Reward for the bad actors who have been hoarding money overseas with the hope. A hope that, oh, please, please bring the money back and invest it in the U.S. No, not so much. And we've seen this movie. It has played out in the past. In 2006 when Bush allowed the big corporations to repatriate. What we found out was CEO pay went up, wages went down, jobs were lost, but the wealth class of the country, the investor wealth class, not you and your 401k and all that stuff, the investor class, they did very, very well. So Obama lays this out, says we're going to cut taxes on business, cut it down to 35 to 28%. People who bring manufacturing, but drop that down to 25. We're going to allow them to repatriate money back. It's a wonderful thing. More write-offs, more loopholes. How do you think the Republicans responded? Do you think they responded by jumping up going, yes, yes, our ideas. He's embraced our ideas. This is what we've wanted. We have wanted to repatriate the money. We have wanted to lower the corporate tax. Do you think they did that? Do you think they jumped up for joy? No. In fact, the report that I read said Republicans reacted icily to Obama's proposal, which they cast as a one-sided deal. And I'm going, yeah, it's a one-sided deal. In my view, the wrong side, the side we've been giving everything to begin with. How much more ring kissing do we have to do? How much more homage to the chair do we have to pay? And you listen to the House Republicans who say, well, you know, we didn't want just a corporate only tax break. We wanted the top people to get tax breaks too. So we're going to oppose it because you didn't give our funders their due. McConnell, which I had to chuckle, criticized it, said, well, you know, it lacked meaningful bipartisan input. What do you mean? You're right. It did lack meaningful bipartisan input. The Democrats really didn't have any input. These are basically the Republican ideas. Unless I'm missing something. Is there something so far that I've seen in this speech that, well, he did call for jobs for the middle class. And I guess that's what the Republicans are upset about. Maybe that's it. I can't think of anything else. Now you got Baucus, the Democrat, saying, well, you know, any of that tax reform's got to be revenue neutral. Okay, revenue neutral, what does that mean? That means if we're going to cut taxes for corporations, we've got to then cut spending on food stamps and on programs that help people, right? Is that what you mean by that? Uh-huh. And then you got the Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, who him and Baucus have been married up on this this tax reform thing, going around on their listening tour. We're in Philadelphia just Monday for their little dog and pony show. Camp, he wants repatriation, but at a very lowest possible rate, and setting up a territorial tax, which would end basically us taxing it entirely, which is another part of why the Republicans are against it. So you give them what they want, basically, but they want more. It never seems to end, does it? You said, well, I would like a pint of blood, please. No, we want two from you. Okay, two. No, we've decided we want four. But I can't live without four. Fine, that's fine. We still want four. I mean, that's the mentality. Now you go, well, what could the president have done? Understand from the beginning, and this is the part that frustrates me a little bit. The president's got to know that no matter what he says, you could give the Republicans everything they ever want, and it's still never going to be enough because, well, that's just how they are. If you give them what they want, they'll go, well, if we got what we wanted, we could get more than we wanted, so let's hold out for more than we wanted. That's the mentality so far. And it's been kind of a learned response. You know, like Dick Cheney said during the Bush years, Democrats, okay, if it's what they do. So it's kind of a learned response that, you know, okay, we got what we wanted. Look at Obamacare. Basically, you know, the Heritage Foundation and all of them got what they wanted back in the 90s. Basically, Romney Care of the early 2000s, they got what they, it wasn't enough. And it's never going to be enough. So what I would have done, I don't know that I would have gone to Amazon. I don't know that I would have gone to a place that is one of the mass importers. I don't know that they sell anything made in the U.S. I don't know that I would have gone to a place where the majority of their workers are temporary workers. I don't know. And I don't know that I would have propped that up as the future of the country. It's like, well, you know, this is what we need. You know, we need employers like Amazon. Well, we've got tons of them. And that's what's leading us in this race for lower wages. Now, I mean, for me, there are some things we need to be doing. We need to be fixing some of the 70,000 structurally deficient bridges in this country. We need to be fixing some of the hundreds of thousands of miles of roads that are crumbling beneath our feet. There's so much we need to be doing. And, you know, I wish the president would have come out and been, you know, look, I know it's never going to pass, but, you know, we're moving the goalposts the other way. We're going to talk about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour like McDonald's said you need to have in order to have a living in this country. It's their own website. They came up with it, not me. I'm not the one who said you work 40 hours at McDonald's and then 40 hours somewhere else to make ends meet. And, oh, by the way, not pay for heat and only pay $20 a month for health care. I didn't make it up. They did. So if I'm the president, I go, look, one of the biggest companies in the country says you got to make $15 an hour, minimum wage. Bang, that's my proposal. That's bold to me. Saying $9 when you'd originally said $10 seems kind of limp. In 2009, the president was right. He said, you know what? This country can no longer be the consumer of last resort. We can no longer be the dumping ground for the world. So for me, I go, you know what? A good place to talk about would be our bad trade policies. So instead of going to Amazon and saying, well, we love the fact that you're buying all this stuff from China and shipping it through and clicking it through, how about encouraging manufacturing and getting Amazon to commit to saying, you know what, we're going to sell a large percentage of American-made goods? Just a thought. You go to 2012 when the president said he was going to add 1 million new manufacturing jobs, yet only 13,000 so far. Look, I mean, his second term, he got plenty of time at some point. But to me, you got to get tough on the trade policies, bad trade deals, tough on China. Tough on them. And as I look at this, China, Japan, currency manipulators. To me, what I would love to see is I would love to see him say, you know what? We need to rethink our trade policies. We need a trade agenda that's going to balance trade. Because for me, there are two. Everyone screams about our debt. Everyone screams about our budget deficits. The real deficit to me that's important is our trade deficit, because that's money leaving the country and then coming back to buy us. I have two very, very strong ideas on how we turn this country around. One is our trade policy, and two is real tax reform to where, you know what, the bigger your shoulders are, the more of the weight of this country you carry, like we used to do during the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower. To me, that seems rational. Not the high dollar policy of the Reagan years, not the high dollar policy of the Larry Summers years, who head of the Fed, are you kidding me? We need to ditch this idea of a strong dollar out the door because it makes our exports way too expensive, and then you can't compete. There's so many things that he could have been doing. And yet, well, what did I see? Repatriation. Got an email here. Ronald writes, Rick, I'm sorry. They don't want more. They want it all. Did the president mean one of those $13 an hour middle class jobs at Amazon's fulfillment center? No, I think he's right. They want it all. And I don't even know it's $13 an hour here in the Carlisle area. Last I was told it was 11 something. And you look over in Allentown, I think it's a bit less than that. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, in the people we've talked to, I remember the Amazon thing where they put air conditioners in temporarily just to meet the requirements. Don't want those workers being comfortable. But I'm kind of disappointed. We're going to talk about that tonight. And the poverty tour continues. We come back and talk a little bit more about the GOP's poverty tour with Jake Wheatley, Pennsylvania State Representative. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The 500 concession stand workers at the San Francisco Giants AT&T ballpark want fair wage increases, job security, and decent health care, but they had to stage a one-day strike to press those very reasonable demands. Unite Here Local 2 represents the workers.
The Giants use contractor Center Plate to run the concession stands. Patricia Ramirez says the workers are just after a fair deal.
Some of the things that we're fighting for is our job security, our health benefits, our wages, pension, you know, things that we need every day to live on here in this expensive Bay Area.
Ramirez says the Giants need to take responsibility for the way the concessions workers are treated. She wants them to step up and help the workers get a fair deal.
The Giants keep saying that the contract dispute is between Center Plate and Local 2, and it has nothing to do with the Giants, but that is not true at all. I mean, the Giants are the ones who, say, for instance, we have a sandwich for $10, and that $5.50 goes to Giants' pocket, pure profit.
Congress is starting to wake up to the movement of low-wage workers demanding an increase in the federal minimum wage. Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan is one of the legislators who is leading the campaign in the House of Representatives. Jesse Russell reports.
Pocan said one of the greatest issues facing the country is the growing income inequality gap.
In the last 40 years, adjusted wages, 90% of Americans have seen an increase of about $59. The top 1% of the top 1% has seen an increase of $18 million. Measured out, that's like 1 inch versus 5 miles of a difference.
Pocan said in addition to raising the minimum wage, he believes giving workers more tools for organizing as a union are fundamental to turning the economy around.
If we can get people back in economically stable position, it overall helps the economy. It's growing the economy from the middle out and the bottom up, which has always been the most sustainable way, and that's what we're proposing.
He said the increase should be between $9 and $11 per hour.
Around the $10 figure seems to be mathematically probably where we should be and where we can probably find the best bump to people to lift people out of poverty, but also make the increase still within a range of where most people really, you know, kind of are paid anyway.
However, Pocan has his doubts that the current Republican-controlled House would be willing to embrace raising the federal minimum.
There's no way this Congress, and we just couldn't pass a farm bill. We've been so unable to do almost anything. But I think it certainly doesn't mean you don't continue to fight for it and talk about it, because the people certainly are with us, and I think we just got to keep agitating.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
I'll tell you, you know, you listen to House Majority Policy Committee Chairman Dave Reed there talking about poverty. Wow, just we got to find out what that one bad decision was, or that one bad circumstance. You know, and my first thought is, you know, in utero, choosing door number one or door number, that was the bad decision for most people because they were born into poverty. And I would argue that a lot of the policies that, well, people of the label of Chairman Reed, they actually work to make poverty that much worse. Show me a policy that the GOME has come forth with that has made poverty better. I mean, attacking the minimum wage, attacking unemployment, attacking health care, you name it, right down the list, eviscerating the general assistance budget. I'm sorry, I'm not buying this newfound caring about the poor, as been talking about the last couple of weeks, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Jake Wheatley to come talk to us about empowering opportunities, ways out of poverty, proposed by Republican Majority Policy Committee Chairman David Reed. Jake, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
So, empowering opportunities. Has the GOP come had a moment of clarity, an epiphany that there are poor people in our Commonwealth that need help?
Well, I've talked to Chairman Reed, and he seems to really be interested in finding out what is working out here in the Commonwealth, if anything, and how they, from their policy perspective, could really promote. Of course, they're not looking to increase spending. They're looking to try to expand programmatically things that they think are successful. And I think what's happening out here, Rick, as you probably are well aware of, the fact of the matter is more and more Pennsylvanians and more Americans are experiencing poverty and food insecurity. And so the general citizenry is demanding that all of us, regardless if we are Republican or Democrat or whatever we label ourselves, we've all at one point in time have experienced it or know someone who are experiencing financial and other concerns, and so we have to address it.
Well, the reality is like I talked about yesterday, the AP had an analysis of census data and some other stuff that showed that 80% of the people in this country at some point are going to find themselves either having lost a job, needing government assistance, a whole bunch of things of people being in poverty at some point in their lives. And I look at the chairman, and I truly do. I truly hope that he does care and that he does want to make things better. But I look at what they've done. And what they've done, in my view, it looks like it's making things worse. I point to eliminating the general assistance budget for tens of thousands of the most vulnerable in our Commonwealth. I look at kicking 41,000 people off of adult basic. I look at kicking almost 90,000 kids off of CHIP. I look at everything that they've done, the unemployment compensation thing, destruction that they did. All of this stuff points to me that they don't care about poverty, and when they do find it, they'll be mission accomplished. We created more.
Well, again, I like to focus on the things that I think we can do. You're right. You're definitely right. Sometimes in the policy decisions we've made, and when I say we, it's the General Assembly, although it's led by the Republican Party right now, I think sometimes we tend to forget that poverty isn't an issue that is a political one. It is one that crosses all of our spectrum. And I think what we have not done is figured out a way to, within our a walk. I'm a co-chair for a hunger caucus. And the fact of the matter is more and more Pennsylvanians are experiencing food insecurity. And what are the things that we can do? Sometimes it does require more resources, but sometimes it just requires us being more sensitive as elected officials around policy perspectives and opening up barriers and talking about how we connect people to the resources that are available. And I think, again, I like to err on the side of maybe the majority party right now is experiencing, they are seeing the same thing that you just laid out, that more and more citizens are experiencing these poverty situations, and maybe this tour that they're on will be an epiphany for them, and maybe it will change the way that they address some of these issues as we come back.
Now, I'm hoping. I absolutely do hope so. But you know, when I look at our governor, who says, you know, people who are unemployed, first that they're lazy and they don't want to work, and then that they're drug addicts and can't pass a drug test, that tells me that, you know, it's not about solutions. It's more about name calling and finger pointing. Where I'd like to talk about, how do we alleviate poverty? I was a kid, grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I know poverty intimately. And I know what worked and what didn't. What worked, making sure that there was food on the table, making sure that when I got sick, I had access to a doctor. And oh, by the way, an education. Those seem to be a good start on ending poverty, don't you think?
Those are great starts. I mean, someone recently just told me that, remember, there's a difference of being in poverty and being distressed. Sometimes we are both. And the difference is that when you're in poverty, you're experiencing, you know, financial hardships, but you have support systems in place. So those who still have support systems in place, they can still find their way out. There are supports for them when they go to education because their parents or someone is still being supportive of them. There are supports when they maybe don't have the job that can provide for themselves. They can still have a network to depend on. But then there are individuals that are distressed, that are impoverished and don't have any supports. And so when government steps in, we really should be figuring out ways to really wrap our support around all of those individuals, but it's definitely those who are in distress. And I think that's where we have failed. We have a lot of families, hardworking families. They are working class citizens. They are trying their best. It's not because they are lazy, but it's because our system, and as you stressed earlier, some policy decisions that we've made from time to time that has caused them further distress. So how do we build a quality safety system that's not one that builds dependency, but allows for empowerment. And I think that's, again, I'm hoping as the Republicans go on their tour, we have talked about ways that we can partner with them in their tour to make sure that they get a broader perspective. And I think Dave Reed has been very open to those suggestions. I'm hoping that what you're seeing here is an honest endeavor to really address this issue. And again, I think, at least from my perspective, we've talked about really partnering with the Republican Policy Committee in ways to really address this, because again, this is a definitely an important issue that we need to address as a state, and one that I think will help our cities and our rural areas alike.
Yeah, I mean, and this view that it's all about the urbans is ludicrous to me. As we talked to Mike Sterla last night, he said, you know, the face of poverty in this state is mostly, you know, white women with children in the rural areas, because that's where a lot of poverty is. And the message I keep hearing from SIP is poverty is only an inner city problem, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, well, we're, the new studies have come out and said the new face of poverty is actually white and suburban. So it's moving from cities, it's moving from rural, and it's actually impacting suburban areas. And again, when you look at, like you said, the major study that talked about 80%, 4 out of 5 Americans at some point in their lifetime will experience a form of poverty, is a serious issue. And no longer can we turn a deaf and blind eye to it. We definitely need to address it head on. I think, again, when you talk about education, when you talk about supporting folks, healthcare is a major cost driver. Again, even the way we define poverty hasn't changed since the early 60s. It doesn't include healthcare costs and transportation costs. And when you really look at it, the new defining moment of poverty, you will see there are many more Americans, many more Pennsylvanians that fall in that. And again, it's not a stigma. We should not stigmatize people for experiencing some form of poverty. What we should do is try to figure out ways to help them, help themselves, grow out of that, because we do know it's a large part of it is a function of our economy.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, I agreed with the Republicans in 2010. It was all about jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet they didn't do any of that. What I saw here in Pennsylvania, when the Republicans took total and absolute control of our government, it was not about jobs. And the guy who calls himself the more jobs governor, it hasn't been about that. It's been about consolidation of power, theft of public assets, and the destruction of public education, which, I gotta be honest, doesn't help anyone to get out of poverty. In fact, all of those things make poverty worse.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the real indication of if there's citizens out there who think this Commonwealth is moving in the wrong direction, they have 1 year left to make themselves known, because what we've always heard is, our current governor won with over 60% of the voters who said they wanted something different than what they had before. So now they will have an opportunity to judge if what they've gotten is what they asked for. And again, I would like to say, I think, from a policy perspective, I think we have to be more strategic about how we impact, and move citizens from where they are. And again, I've always stressed the fact that this is not about government helping people who aren't trying to help themselves. This is government reflecting that people are out there struggling to survive day to day, and they do need opportunities, real opportunities. We need a transportation bill that will provide real opportunities for citizens to get to and from work and to health facilities. We need to expand our Medicaid assistance and get more people quality health care for themselves and their families. And this is not the extremely poor, but this is just the middle class working poor.
So now
these things will help them.
So now on this initiative, because you've laid out two of the big things that I think are extremely important, where's Chairman Reed and his policy initiative towards ending poverty, the empowering opportunities? Where's that when it comes to passing the transportation bill, which I think is desperately needed? And the sad reality is I think we're already screwed on that front, because even if you pass it in the fall, you've already missed construction season. So any good that it's going to do is not going to be felt for another year. So now we've got more people feeling the pinch. But it's, getting it passed in the fall would still be a start. And the Medicaid expansion, which is going to save rural hospitals and is going to put people to work. To me, no-brainers.
I agree. I think as they go on their tour, I think the more they hear from citizens throughout this Commonwealth that those things are important, the hope that I have is that we'll come back in the fall and those things will be a part of the agenda discussion. I really think that we're close on transportation. I think that you'll hear more and more Republicans asking and working to, across the aisle to get a solid transportation plan together and voted on. And I think we're pretty close on Medicaid expansion. Again, I think the hope that I have is that the fact that the Republican Policy Committee led by Representative Reed has taken the initiative to go out there and hear from citizens directly, and I think this is an opportunity for citizens to really state the case for why policy shifts need to be made, and hopefully they will listen and we'll come back and we'll get things done.
Do you really think you're going to be able to get the Medicaid expansion through?
I'm always, if I didn't have
okay, you're the eternal optimist. I get it.
Yeah, if not, I couldn't do my job and be successful with it. And I think that, again, the more they hear, the more that we all hear from citizens that it is required and they want it, the more likelihood we'll get it done.
So let me ask last line of questioning I've got for you then. You know, in looking at this, one, where are they going? Where have they been? Who are they meeting with? Because for me, poverty starts with a job. And once you get a job and once you can make a living wage, you can pull yourself out of poverty, which for me, first and foremost, we need a raise in the minimum wage. We need health care for people, a little retirement security, not a bad thing. So to me, the other part of this is encouraging people to join and form unions and collectively bargain for a better living like I was able to do that helped pull me out of poverty. So I think there's a lot of policy initiatives that I think Democrats and Republicans, as they used to work together on, should at some point in the future come back to that.
Well, let's start with the baby step that they have initiated, and that is at least they're interested in hearing from everyday regular folk out here in the Commonwealth. I don't know the schedule. We're trying to figure out how we can join in. I haven't seen their, but I've been told by Representative Reed that they're trying to go all across the Commonwealth and get a good sample size of what people are experiencing. I think that, so we should actually be encouraged that they're taking that step. They didn't have to do it. They're taking that step. The second part of it to go to your broader question is the only way things will change drastically and get Republicans and Democrats back to working together are the people out there that are in need of us to work together.
Yep.
And if they don't come and ask us to do something more than what we've been doing or put fires under all of us to really address their needs, then we really won't do anything. So I put it back in the hands of the citizens and say, take this opportunity to really express what you want from your General Assembly over the next several months and what you send back, because we all go back out on elections starting in January, and who you send back to Harrisburg is important as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, but I got to be honest, and I know you're the optimist here. I got to be honest, I'm a little jaded, a little cynical. I look at this as nothing but a ploy. I look at it as, you know, all of the things that the policies that they pursued the past 2 years at least, I believe, have made poverty worse. And one of the things that they did do before they left was to try and pass the payday lending thing as some kind of anti-poverty program. I don't know. Just seems wrong-headed and in the absolute wrong direction to me.
Well, I think the best thing we can do, Rick, is you can keep educating your listeners. We can keep encouraging your listeners to participate fully. When they have an opportunity to come to one of these hearings or roundtable discussions, they should do so, and they should continue to advocate for their best interest.
Yep.
And I think at the end of the day, if we get more citizens to do that, we will see the changes that we all want in Pennsylvania.
I'm with you. Representative Jake Wheatley, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
It was great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pscu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Well, finally, hard right congressional leaders and the Obama White House have agreed that interest rates on student loans should not double to nearly 7% as they let happen early in July. Instead, college students will be billed at a rate that will steadily rise to above 8%. This is progress? Well, yes, in that this year's rate would drop to 3.8%. But for the longer run, obviously not. Even capping the interest rate at 8.25%, as the White House demanded, is too high, for it still saddles students with a crushing debt of some $20,000 to $40,000 for a four-year degree, just as they're getting started on their economic path. But worse, lawmakers are playing small ball, avoiding the big issue. Bickering over percentages shrivels the public debate to its most picayune and meanest point, which our so-called leaders seem to specialize in these days. They focus on the price of everything without grasping the value of anything. And the value of a college education, not only to America's youth, but most significantly to our whole society's economic and democratic future, is clearly established. So the big question we should be asking is this: why isn't higher education free? As Les Leopold of the Labor Institute notes in a July 2nd alternate piece, for over 150 years, our nation has recognized that tuition-free primary and secondary schools were absolutely vital to the growth and functioning of our Commonwealth. Today, open access to a college degree or other advanced training is as vital to America as a high school diploma has been in our past. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget interest rates. Our young people should not be blocked by a massive debt load from getting the education that they need, but also that all of America needs them to have for our mutual prosperity and democratic strength.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising, but the wage is. Everything's raising, but the wage is. Gasoline closer than a hate is. Everything's raising, but the wage is.
Oh, yes, all we have to do, end the minimum wage. That would make poverty so much better, right? You can't make that up. I mean, really, you can't make it up. And as I said from the beginning, this whole charade that the Republicans on the state level are doing, it's just that. You want to end poverty, you raise the minimum wage. You want to end poverty, you help get people some basic health care so that they, when they get sick, they don't end up in the street. You get people education, and most of all, you know, stop calling them names. Stop, you know, like the governor said, a lot of poor people, they're lazy. You can't pass a drug test. So lazy or drug addicts? Really? Insane stuff. And I look at what's been going on. Yesterday we talked with fast food workers from St. Louis. Said, you know what? We need to have a living wage. And even McDonald's themselves agreed that $15 an hour is what the minimum wage should be. Their website, not mine. I didn't make it up. You can see it yourself. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. But here to talk to us a little bit about the Fast Food Forward campaign, and he was in New York City yesterday with the fast food workers who took to the streets to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, Congressman Matt Cartwright. Congressman, thanks for taking time for us.
How you doing, Rick?
I am good. Congratulations, and thank you for getting out in the streets and fighting for working people.
Well, you know me, Rick. I think the last time we saw each other was at my end of sequester rally in in Pittston, Pennsylvania. Remember that?
Absolutely. And I was screaming about the Screwquester then and how it was going to harm us and cost us jobs. And, you know, I see reports now anywhere from 900,000 to 1.6 million jobs are going to be lost because of it.
Yeah, that figure, 1.6 million, is as of the end of 2014, if they continue that. And God help us if they do.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why you're there, to help stop it.
Well, you know, I don't mind getting out and screaming and shouting for the regular people in this country, and I was very proud on behalf of the Congressional Progressive Caucus to appear on Court Street in Brooklyn Monday as part of the Fast Food Forward campaign. I'm going to say we had probably 50, 60 people, which was an effort to keeping them all on the sidewalk.
Yeah,
I was out there, you know, whipping up the crowd a little bit, talking about our issues. Treating fast food workers like they're disposable people is not the right approach, in my view.
Well, we've been treating workers like disposable people. And for me, I've been saying for the longest time, we need to do what my grandparents' generation did and make the jobs that are here today, like in the past, the factory and the truck driving jobs, they made those jobs. They created middle class jobs out of what were sweatshop jobs. We can do the same thing with fast food and retail today, I believe.
Well, you know, it's a point that's not lost on many of the progressives, that Henry Ford, of all people, believed that paying his workers a living wage was so important because he could see the big picture. And the big picture is, if you don't pay the workers enough to buy your own products, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yep.
So he knew that, and... But, you know, you hear it time and time again. Employers saying, oh, no, Matt, laddie, if we raise the minimum wage to, you know, to $10, to $12, to $15, if we do that, it's going to lead to layoffs because we can only afford to employ so many people. And if the bottom tier of workers are making $10, $12, $15 an hour, we can't afford to hire as many workers. Well, number one, they always say that. They say that about wages. They say that about benefits. For crying out loud, they said it about the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. Well, they still are. And the reality is no one's been able to point to me to a credible study to me that says that bears that out.
Well, right. It's just an easy catch line for them to intone, and they do it all the time. But I think more important than that is something that a lot of people don't think about and they don't realize. I was with a family in Kingston, Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, on Friday. And the mother and the father both work at minimum wage jobs. The father works at a fast food restaurant. The mother actually is applying for a minimum wage job at one of the big box outlets that we all know about.
Right.
And but here's the thing. Even if she gets the job, they're still both going to be working for minimum wage. And because they have a child, they qualify for WIC benefits. They qualify for all sorts of federal programs, Head Start. They qualify for food stamps. And what does that mean? It means that you're paying people who are working full time, 40 hours a week, mom and dad. You're paying them not enough to elevate them out of poverty, and as a result, the federal government has to step in and make sure the kids get fed, the kids get Head Start. We have all of this federal money doing what? Subsidizing the labor force for these employers that refuse to pay a living wage.
Well, and we've allowed them to set up business models based on the social safety net that the Republicans are trying to destroy. And I look at this and I say, you know, to me, this is why I'm such a union advocate. You know, my grandmother, she worked in a retail store back in 1985 when she retired. She was making $8 an hour in 1985 with full health care, full benefits, retirement that she enjoys to this day, 6 weeks vacation, eye, dental, all of that stuff. So you can't tell me that it's not possible, because I've seen that it is possible. It's that we haven't held employers to account because the power of workers to organize has been destroyed.
And, Rick, the labor movement, collective bargaining rights, they are they're not the end. They are a means to the end. What's the end? It's keeping America the recognizable place that we all know, the place where the meekest among us can rise to the top, where there is social mobility,
yep.
where average working people have a hope of climbing into the middle class and out of the middle class to achieve the American dream. That's what makes America the greatest nation on earth, the fact that we have a middle class, the fact that we have these opportunities, these hopes, these dreams, these chances for success in this country. It's what makes everybody in the world want to come to America, because we have this is the land of opportunity. Well, if we destroy the middle class, if we pay them so little that they are by definition in poverty, what are we doing to our middle class? We're destroying it, and we're destroying the definition of the America that you and I know and love.
And the other part of this is, not only are you destroying that upward mobility and that valuable middle class, what I guess the very wealthy in this country don't realize is, once you destroy that, you destroy your wealth as well, because the wealth is created out of that big middle class that has disposable income, that can buy cars, that can buy books on at Amazon, and can afford to buy things and have disposable income to keep the economy moving, which creates more jobs. I mean, you've got two directions. You can spiral up and grow, or you can continue to contract and spiral downward, which is what austerity and Screwquester and all of this stuff has brought us.
Well, that's right, Rick. And it comes down to what do you want our country to be like? You want it to be the envy of the free world, the way it has been the whole 20th century, with people striving to come here to escape the draconian, terrible places that they've lived, where they don't have a chance, where they do desperate things to get into this country, because look at what they're escaping from.
You mean like having cantaloupes for calves? The 100-pound kids walking across the desert with cantaloupes for calves?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean, have you smacked him? Because I would. I got to be honest. I could never do your job. I'll put that on the table. Because I would reach across the table and just smack him across the back of the head. Because my grandfather always said, sometimes you need to smack somebody to make a citizen out of them. Steve King's a guy who needs to be smacked, in my view.
Well, my approach, Rick, is to try to make friends and try to win people over with the logic and argument and good, sensible talk.
That's why you're the congressman and I'm the guy on the other end of the microphone.
Well, Rick, you know I always love calling in and talk to you.
So what did you think of the president's speech today?
I'll tell you what, it just about every time the president speaks, it gives me hope for the future. He has such a command of where he wants to go, who he is. In fact, I'm very much looking forward to our meeting with him tomorrow in the Democratic caucus, tomorrow at 10 o'clock. We're going to be meeting with, President Obama, and I always enjoy those meetings, and I've been encouraging that, you know, in my own way to try to suggest that President Obama spend more time on Capitol Hill, because that's the traditional way you get business done. My favorite legislator was Lyndon Johnson. The things that he achieved, the legislation that he pushed through.
Today, 1965, he signed Medicare and Medicaid into law.
Medicare and Medicaid, and you know, you can't really let a day like this go by without mentioning Lyndon Johnson. And the way he did it was a lot of wearing out the telephone, a lot of backslapping with legislators on Capitol Hill. And to my mind, that's the model. That is the way we help out the middle class and the working folks in this country, is we roll up our sleeves and we do what Lyndon Johnson did, work like hell to help people in this country.
I'm right there with you. Last question I've got for you. You recently introduced the Closing Loopholes and Ending Arbitrary and Needless Evasion of Regulations Act, the Cleaner Act. Quick, what is it?
The Cleaner Act is the second in a series of bills that I'm introducing to remove loopholes that are built into the environmental laws for the oil and gas industry.
Good.
There's really absolutely no reason why the oil and gas industry should be exempt from handling hazardous waste in the regulated manner in which all of the rest of American industry has to handle its hazardous waste. There's no logical reason why the oil and gas industry should be exempt from that. We can't say that they're putting on the poor mouth. They can't afford.
They give big money. They give big donations. That exempts them.
Well, that is the only reason, and it's not a good logical reason.
I'm with you.
It's force majeure. It's just throwing their weight around, and I intend to be a loud voice my entire time in the Congress against that kind of heavy-handed politics, money politics. Mm-hmm. And the only way to stop that is to shine a light on it, and I'm trying to do that. I've introduced the Cleaner Act to remove the exemptions from RCRA, which is the environmental law on hazardous waste, for the oil and gas companies. And prior to that, I introduced the Fresher Act, which was to do the same thing, remove exemptions for the oil and gas industry from stormwater runoff regulations as well. Look, there's such, it, not only is that industry easily capable of paying for doing it right and protecting the environment, but they're also an industry that is so much more likely to be the ones actually polluting the environment. So it just doesn't make any sense. The only reason it's there is that they were throwing their money around on lobbying, and they were very successful at it for so many years, and it's time to put that to an end.
I'm right there with you, which is why you're one of my favorite members of Congress. Congressman Matt Cartwright, it's great talking with you. Please come back again early and often.
You bet, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Yeah, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, this, what's gone on the past couple of years, to me, you know, the fast food thing, it's kind of the head. It's kind of, you know, now we're starting to see people, had enough. Congressman Cartwright out in the street, and we need more people in politics to get out in front of this. This is a movement, I think, that is growing legs. Every time we talk about it, and we've been talking about it for months now. Started out with a couple of people, started out with just a handful, then a couple more. Like he said, 60 people on the street corner, couldn't even keep them on the sidewalk. Next time it'll be more and more. That's how a movement grows. And it's to me, we should all be getting involved in this stuff because that's how we change this country. And as Representative Cartwright pointed out, you know, people come here from all around the world for that opportunity. And, you know, when I was a kid, there were people swimming from Cuba to try and get here. You got, well, the kids with, you know, cantaloupe calves, which I still can't believe he got away with saying. I mean, seriously, if I were a congressman, there's a lot of that stuff. If I were in the, you just have to smack somebody. And I know, and as the congressman pointed out, he's a little more eloquent than I am, and chooses to discuss things a little more. I think at some point you just got to go smack. What's wrong with you? Just a thought. It's like the poverty issue. I mean, there's some people I think you just need to smack. So, duh. You know, what were you thinking? I don't know. Anyway, But I listened to the president's speech today, and you know, there were some things in there that, I'm with you. The trade stuff, got to get stronger on that. The repatriation, I'm just about ready to pull my hair out over. Lowering the tax rates, again, I've yet to find a credible study that's pointed to lowering tax rates as something that works. Just interesting stuff. Anyway, got an email from Brian who said, talking about unemployment, which I brought up earlier. He said he had a phone call at his office asking why Obama had eliminated unemployment benefits for seasonal workers. He wrote an interesting statement here. Told the caller, you do realize it's a state benefit, right? And that it's your governor, Tom Corbett, who changed the rules. And that's the thing that gets me. There's been an awful lot of talk about unemployment being a federal benefit that I think some people think, well, it's Obama's. Because Obama was, they were pointing fingers at him for extending it. The extended portion of unemployment is federal. The first 26 weeks, those are state benefits. The federal money, which Congress, the purse, allocates, this really has nothing to do with Obama, which I always find interesting. Oh, it's Obama. Not even understanding basic procedure of government, which Congress is the purse, right? They decide how the money's spent. The president says, I'd like to spend money on this. Republicans in the House say, no, we want austerity, which how we got Screwquester. Obama proposed it, thought it was there's an idea they might go for, and it would be so draconian that even they wouldn't allow it to happen. Little did he know he was giving them the atomic bomb, going, here, destroy the country. Congratulations. I'm giving you the keys to destroy the country and then being able to blame me for it. Interesting. I love that. Oh, boy. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com, that's where the podcast is always there. Stitcher on your smartphone. You can email me, Rick@RickSmithShow.com. If there's anything I've said, got on your mind, questions, comments, whatever I've said that's gotten under the fingernails, the skin there, I'd love to hear it. We're going to take a quick break. Back with the second hour of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the top.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The 500 concession stand workers at the San Francisco Giants AT&T ballpark want fair wage increases, job security, and decent health care. But they had to stage a one-day strike to press those very reasonable demands. Unite Here Local 2 represents the workers. The Giants use contractor Center Plate to run the concession stands. Patricia Ramirez says the workers are just after a fair deal.
Some of the things that we're fighting for is our job security, our health benefits, our wages, pension, you know, things that we need every day to live on here in this expensive Bay Area.
Ramirez says the Giants need to take responsibility for the way the concessions workers are treated. She wants them to step up and help the workers get a fair deal.
The Giants keep saying that the contract dispute is between Center Plate and Local 2, and it has nothing to do with the Giants, but that is not true at all. I mean, the Giants are the ones who, say, for instance, we have a sandwich for $10, and that $5.50 goes to the Giants' pocket, pure profit.
Congress is starting to wake up to the movement of low-wage workers demanding an increase in the federal minimum wage. Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan is one of the legislators who is leading the campaign in the House of Representatives. Jesse Russell reports.
Pocan said one of the greatest issues facing the country is the growing income inequality gap.
In the last 40 years, adjusted wages, 90% of Americans have seen an increase of about $59. The top 1% of the top 1% has seen an increase of $18 million. Measured out, that's like 1 inch versus 5 miles of a difference.
Hokan said in addition to raising the minimum wage, he believes giving workers more tools for organizing as a union are fundamental to turning the economy around.
If we can get people back in economically stable position, it overall helps the economy. It's growing the economy from the middle out and the bottom up, which has always been the most sustainable way, and that's really what we're proposing.
He said the increase should be between $9 and $11 per hour.
Around the $10 figure seems to be mathematically probably where we should be and where we can probably find the best bump to people to lift people out of poverty, but also make the increase still within a range of where most people really, you know, kind of are paid anyway.
However, Pocan has his doubts that the current Republican-controlled House would be willing to embrace raising the federal minimum.
There's no way this Congress, and we just couldn't pass a farm bill. We've been so unable to do almost anything. But I think it certainly doesn't mean you don't continue to fight for it and talk about it, because the people certainly are with us, and I think we just got to keep agitating.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit labor.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Back at after the election of 2012, when Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan said, it's the urbans. It's all about the urbans. You know, Obama only won because the urbans got free stuff. You know, handouts for those urbans, those poor people, which, you know, I thought was very interesting. And then you look at right now, the we're going to hand out all of this money to big agribusiness. In fact, 74% of all the money for agriculture goes to 4% of the big multinational, mega giant corporations. To me, that's welfare. So when I saw this July 27th Tribune Democrat article talking about the AARP of Pennsylvania trying to get seniors to apply for food stamps and the right wing losing their mind, because according to AARP, there are 350,000 Pennsylvania seniors who are food insecure and don't have the money to buy food, and that this program should help them. You got people screaming, oh, why should we help them? All the while trying to destroy the social safety net. And to me, this whole demonizing of people who needs assistance, like Jen Stefano's piece on, well, you know, 1 in 4 people get food stamps. Yeah, there's something wrong with that. And here to help us discuss some of this, Craig Harrington. He's an economic researcher over at Media Matters. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So I look at this, and there's this vitriol, there's this finger pointing that anyone who needs help in this economy, anyone who's struggling, that somehow that they're lazy, they're stupid, or it's their fault. At least that seems to be the meme that I'm getting. What are you guys seeing over at Media Matters?
This is actually something that we talk about on the econ research team pretty much all the time. The right-wing media, particularly. The right-wing media, particularly led by Fox News, they continually try to portray people who are using any sort of government assistance as being lazy, as being, the term welfare queens comes up a lot, and they never portray these people as being honest recipients of a government entitlement that they paid for with their tax dollars and they're receiving to keep them from slipping down further into poverty.
That doesn't fit their maker-taker frame. And I would argue, in looking at, you know, to me, the farm bill is a crystal clear example of the hypocrisy on the right. Because when you're talking about welfare, being 74% of the money spent on the agriculture for farmers goes to 4% of the farmers. To me, that seems like welfare for just a handful, and screw everybody else.
It's the farm bill action in particular was a sad day to be watching C-SPAN for all of us, the dozens of us out there who watch C-SPAN religiously. Food stamps, what was then called food stamps, which now called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, or SNAP, these two things have been buttoned together as part of a farm bill since 1949. It's been it was an intentional way of tying rural districts with urban districts, tying rural voters into urban voters, and having two constituencies that don't share a lot of core demands in the federal government into an important program that helped both of them. And what we saw in the last in this government is a detaching of the farm bill and food stamp and SNAP assistance for the first time in half a century. And what we have is a possibility of passing what will essentially be hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate welfare to checks that are going to Manhattan and Washington, D.C. For agribusiness companies. While at the same time, we're going to have a real fight and potentially have a significant loss for recipients of nutritional assistance. This is the first time this has happened in generations, in a lifetime for many Americans. And it's honestly, it's been a shocking development.
And for me, it really a major shift in national thinking. I mean, that we're going to make sure that the well-to-do are even more well-to-do, while the folks who are struggling at the bottom, through most of the time, through no fault of their own, they just picked the wrong door at birth because they were born into poverty. The hell with them, it seems to be the rationale. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, even if you don't have boots.
There's just this false equivalency, particularly with recipients of nutritional assistance. What we've seen, nutritional assistance registries have been growing since 2001. This is something that grew all throughout the Bush administration, and no right-wing media voiced any opinion negatively or positively against it. But as soon as a Democratic administration comes into office, as soon as President Obama is elected, all of a sudden the right-wing media has turned its vitriol against what it sees as a growing registry of food stamp recipients and of people that are perceived to be unworthy of getting this sort of government handout, which to people who are receiving the assistance, this is the difference between dire poverty and survivability. But so far as the right-wing media is concerned and the way that the conservative voices have built this in the media in general, it's this idea that if a government program expands, if recipient registries expand, it must be because of graft or abuse or fraud and not because of systemic economic problems that have clear beginnings and which have a clear terminus if we're willing to actually advocate programs that can really take them on.
Well, to me, you know, we've got a representative here in the state, a Republican chairman of the Republican Policy Committee, who's on a poverty listening tour. He's now found out that there are people living in poverty. He's going to figure it out. Even though for the last couple of years they've been working on every policy they can think of to make poverty worse, he's now thinking, well, we're going to go out and see what poverty looks like. And as I've said, I mean, it's a finger-pointing tour. It's your fault, you're poor, you're lazy, you're stupid, can't pass a drug test, as our governor has said. But I look at this, and, you know, the frame out there, the media frame out there is, you know, the Americans for Prosperity shill mouthpiece here in the state said that, well, you're not only supporting your family, but you're feeding someone else's family.
Yeah.
Pointing to the neighbors and dividing communities without, in my view, really looking at the true welfare queens, the true drivers of our debt and poverty, which are the folks who sit in our CEO boardrooms and on Wall Street that we give massive subsidies to.
Yeah, you know, right now, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, derisively known as food stamps in the right-wing media, in the last fiscal year, in 2012, it had a budget item of about $75 billion, which is a little bit more than $75 billion. That was how much it cost the federal government to help 50 million people literally avoid starvation for $75 billion. $75 billion is less than the cost of the height of the Iraq or Afghanistan wars. $75 billion is less than the amount of bailout funds that was given to AIG and various other financial and banking conglomerates at the height of the financial crash. We're fighting right now over whether or not we're going to allow nearly 50 million Americans to literally quite possibly struggle with starvation over a budget item that's one-tenth of what we allocate to defense and national security. It's not a reasonable fight.
No,
and it's something that wouldn't have worked any other time in American history, perhaps.
And the thing that gets me is you go back to the Bush collapse. You go back to September of 2008 when the economy was in free fall. If it's not for SNAP, for food stamps, if it's not for unemployment compensation insurance, if it's not for the elasticity programs that kept this economy from terminal velocity, free fall to the bottom, we would have been in a mass depression. Instead, it was just a very serious recession, and some would argue, you know, borderline depression, but we kept people from absolute collapse.
I remember the first time, Rick, that you had me on was a few years ago, and we were talking about the height of the economic collapse and how things were really, really going south. And one of the things that we've seen in the last few years is that these programs like Social Security insurance, like unemployment insurance, like food assistance, they have kept us from developing really staggering, potentially offensively high poverty rates. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, they just recently had a little infographic that showed how the poverty rate in the United States is about 16% right now, how it would go up if we cut certain social safety net programs. And if you were to cut Social Security insurance, for example, the poverty rate would spike by almost 50%. It would go from 16 to over 24. If you were to cut just food assistance, it would go from 16 to nearly 20. These are things that have a noticeable economic stimulative effect, which are also incredibly important for people who are surviving because they are receiving recipients of SNAP or WIC or Social Security or unemployment insurance. There are Americans out there whose only lifeline, whose only difference between paying the bills and not paying the bills, is this little bit of government assistance that they paid for when they were working and that they are entitled to. And the idea that we might take these things away from hardworking Americans who have fallen on tough times is really, really difficult to understand.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And to me, I go back to the Bush years, and the reason I brought Bush up is because it's my understanding that it was the Bush years that caused the mass expansion of food stamps, and it was actually his policy, and it's one of the things I give him credit for. He saw his policies cause mass suffering and mass food insecurity, or as we used to call it, hunger, and actually used a mechanism of government to help make things a little bit less bad. So I give him credit. It's very little things I give him credit for. That's one of the things I do give him credit for.
And that actually, that's entirely true. In the state of Pennsylvania, for example, the Bush administration and Governor Rendell, they did a lot to really cut out a lot of fraud and waste in the food stamp program. In 1993, when Bill Clinton first took over as the president of the United States, and he took over administering what was then called food stamps, which is now SNAP, they had 4%. They had a waste rate of 4%, or 4 cents on the dollar. The waste rate is today is closer to a quarter of a cent on the dollar. And in a lot of ways, the Bush administration deserves some credit for overseeing 8 years in which they saw SNAP abuse and fraud and waste rates decline. But at the same time, we can't just ignore the fact that that there is a historical trajectory and that there is some economic inertia behind the accumulation of bigger SNAP registries, of bigger benefit registries. The whole reason that more and more Americans are living off of these government benefits, and not just living off of them, but truly surviving off of them, this is the difference between making it and breaking it for a lot of Americans. And the whole reason we see these registries expand is because of the fact that the economy went in the wrong direction for the vast majority. And more people saw themselves tumbling down the economic ladder for the first time really in American history.
Now, and it comes back to the jobs thing. I mean, to me, in 2010, the Republicans said jobs, 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 and yet have done everything that they can possibly do to not allow jobs to be created. And in fact, I look at the president's speech today, and I guess I'll throw it out here. You know, what were your thoughts of the speech? Because I don't know what your thoughts are. I'm curious. What were before we get into what I thought?
Oh, Rick, I was watching it on Fox News. They didn't cover 1 second of the speech. I didn't know the president was even giving a speech today.
So you got the Republican talking points against it.
Yeah, we actually wrote an article on Media Matters today about the fact that Fox News was doing a live rebuttal and reaction to the president's speech without actually even watching 1 second. They didn't air on Fox News Channel 1 second of words spoken by President Obama regarding economic policy proposals today. I was able to actually watch the speech in real time and then watch a recording of it as well and follow a transcript. And the president's proposals are fairly similar to things that he's been espousing for years, but every policy that he takes a stance in affirmation of that might possibly be something that could be Republican boilerplate or that could be a GOP talking point or a right-wing media talking point, more importantly, a media talking point, is something that they just immediately and universally oppose. When he talks about using some federal dollars to stimulate the economy through investments, they immediately respond to the word investment by saying that it's spending, and then he just becomes a standard tax and spend Democrat, which fits into a 30-year narrative that the right-wing media has been working against the Democratic Party and against progressive proposals from Democrats and Republicans.
Right. You know, as I looked at it, you know, to me, the repatriation thing popped out at me. It seemed, you know, I listened to the Republican responses, which were, he's giving us everything we want, but it's still not enough.
Yeah, we clipped a very interesting headline that showed up on Fox News today, where they had in the ticker two Fox News anchors who were talking about the president's proposal to cut corporate tax rates, and they listed some GOP and Republican opposition to the president's proposal to cut corporate tax rates because cutting corporate tax rates would hurt small businesses. And so essentially the talking point they were running on Fox News during the afternoon, instead of covering the president's speech, was they were arguing that the GOP is now against a GOP platform position to cut corporate tax rates because it would hurt small businesses. Literally, the president could say the sky is blue, and they would come out the next day and oppose it.
And that's what basically where I've been on this whole thing. Anyway, Craig, it was great talking with you. We're not gonna wait so long next time. We'd like to have you back again. As often as you want.
3 years is too long to go without you, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Craig Harrington, economic researcher at Media Matters. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Well, finally, hard-right congressional leaders and the Obama White House have agreed that interest rates on student loans should not double to nearly 7% as they let happen early in July. Instead, college students will be billed at a rate that will steadily rise to above 8%. This is progress? Well, yes, in that this year's rate would drop to 3.8%. But for the longer run, obviously not. Even capping the interest rate at 8.25%, as the White House demanded, is too high, for it still saddles students with a crushing debt of some $20,000 to $40,000 for a four-year degree, just as they're getting started on their economic path. But worse, lawmakers are playing small ball, avoiding the big issue. Bickering over percentages shrivels the public debate to its most picayune and meanest point, which our so-called leaders seem to specialize in these days. They focus on the price of everything without grasping the value of anything, and the value of a college education not only to America's youth, but most significantly to our whole society's economic and democratic future, is clearly established. So the big question we should be asking is this. Why isn't higher education free? As Les Leopold of the Labor Institute notes in a July 2nd alternate piece, for over 150 years, our nation has recognized that tuition-free primary and secondary schools were absolutely vital to the growth and functioning of our Commonwealth. Today, open access to a college degree or other advanced training is as vital to America as a high school diploma has been in our past. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget interest rates. Our young people should not be blocked by a massive debt load from getting the education that they need, but also that all of America needs them to have for our mutual prosperity and democratic strength.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So I'm really, I got to be honest, looking forward to 2016, to the GOP primary, the whole presidential thing heating up already as Governor Christie from New Jersey and Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, kind of sniping at each other, because evidently Christie called Rand Paul a Tea Party who favors big spending, big spending Washington establishment. In fact, Christie said at a press conference that about Rand Paul, maybe he, Rand Paul, should start cutting the pork barrel spending he brings home to Kentucky. He went on to say, but I doubt he will because most Washington politicians only care about bringing home the bacon so they can get reelected. Now, you got to look at the numbers. And this is where Christie's got a leg to stand on. When New Jersey sends a dollar to Washington, they get about 61 cents back. But when Kentucky sends a dollar to Washington, they get $1.51 back. So I would argue, and there's part of me that goes, maybe the senators from New Jersey need to do a better job because you want to talk about wealth redistribution? The states like New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania to a point, and Connecticut, and Massachusetts, all of the northeastern states seem to be losing wealth, sending it to Washington, and shipping it to states that hate the federal government. This is what's always blown my mind. Okay, you hate the government. Hate them. We're going to destroy the federal government, but we want their money. I mean, we're the dupes in this, because we keep sending all this money down south, and, well, they hate us. Or so their politicians, the Republicans, do. Now, it's been an interesting feud back and forth because, on Thursday, Christie went after Rand Paul, saying that there was some, creeping strain of libertarianism within the party on national security issues. Rand Paul, not to sit down, was struck back, saying Christie was sad and cheap. For using the cloak of 9/11 victims to shield his position and accuse Christie of a gimme, all the money approach to fiscal issues in Washington because of the hurricane. And so it's been this kind of sniping back and forth. Now, those would be interesting debates because, you looked at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when they had the GOP primary in 2012. Nobody really dominant. I think Christie would be entertaining as hell in that forum. Just from a pure entertainment standpoint, I think it would be something very interesting. But, it comes back to this money issue. And you talk about redistribution of wealth. And the Tea Party loves to throw that out. The Rand Paul people love to talk about redistribution of wealth. Look at that redistribution. You're taking 39 cents out of New Jersey, and you're spreading it to places like Kentucky and other places. The states' rights people should be in New Jersey, and the people who love the federal government should be in Kentucky, where they're reaping mass benefit. And that's what's weird about our system. It's kind of upside down where the people who are reaping the benefits are going, no, don't do that. It's not nice. But we'll take all your money anyway. It just blows my mind. And I guess it comes back to us, doesn't it? It comes back to we, the voter. And as I sit back and I think about, you know, how we got into this mess. I mean, think about how we got here, where we're blaming the poor. And I've had these conversations with people recently because I've had some, you know, some work people over to the house where they've been kind of sequestered in my house to have to, you know, have to listen to me for a bit. Talking about some of these issues, pointing their fingers at people they see. And I think that's the problem. I think the problem is we see occasionally someone who's needs a SNAP benefit and maybe not be using it the way that we think they should. Like, how dare you have a piece of candy? You know, I think back to when I was a kid. When I was a kid, they didn't have electronic debit cards. They had these big clownish-looking food stamps. And I remember being humiliated and degraded by it, which I don't think any kid should ever have to feel degraded or humiliated because they're hungry. I'm sorry, you've lost me on that. But I remember going into a store, and my mother had said, you know, you need to pick, please get these things because this is what we're going to make for dinner, and all I have is, you know, we have these food stamps. And I went to the store, and I bought the things that were on the list, and I was allowed to get one of the Nutter Butter bars, which, you know, as a kid was just, oh, my God, that's fantastic, I love that. I took it up to the counter, and the woman made such a stink about, is he allowed to buy this? And I'll never forget that, judging what it is that I was buying. I don't think people should have that kind of power. I just don't. Fortunately, if we live in a stand your ground state, maybe we can shoot her in the future. But I think about that often, and I think about this whole, it's what we see in front of us. It's the people that we see. And it's not the mass theft of resources by the people that we never see. You know, we have created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. The robber barons of the 1880s and 1890s are going, man, how'd you do that? And you got people to think you're poor? Wow. And to give you more tax breaks? How'd you do that? We couldn't do that, and we had the military we could call out to shoot people. Wow. You robber barons of the 21st century, you to bomb. Because they really have. They figured out how to keep us pitted against one another while they are robbing us blind. I mean, it's like the skinny guy at the table ate all ten of the 10 cookies and blaming the fat guy. Hey, it was his fault. He did it. Everyone knows he did. The guy's going, I didn't get a cookie. And we all blame the other guy. I mean, it's amazing to me. And what's really amazing is the people I've talked to recently, it's not even on their mind that the handful, some, you know, you're talking about maybe 3 million people in this country, the 1%, they're the ones who have, I mean, reaped unimaginable fortunes. It's just, it's absolutely mind-blowing to me. It comes back down to education, though. It comes down to the propaganda machine in full tilt. I mean, you look at the, as Craig Harrington pointed out, Fox News was going to run the speech, didn't run a second of it, but spewed every right-wing talking point. Because facts don't matter. Propaganda, that's what matters. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, talk a little bit about transportation, why we can't get it, is it going to happen in the fall, so much more. Your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're
listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The 500 concession stand workers at the San Francisco Giants AT&T ballpark want fair wage increases, job security, and decent health care. But they had to stage a one-day strike to press those very reasonable demands. Unite Here Local 2 represents the workers. The Giants use contractor Center Plate to run the concession stands. Patricia Ramirez says the workers are just after a fair deal.
Some of the things that we're fighting for is our job security, our health benefits, our wages, pensions, you know, things that we need every day to live on here in this expensive Bay Area.
Ramirez says the Giants need to take responsibility for the way the concessions workers are treated. She wants them to step up and help the workers get a fair deal.
The Giants keep saying that the contract dispute is between Center Plate and Local 2, and it has nothing to do with the Giants, but that is not true at all. I mean, the Giants are the ones who, say, for instance, we have a sandwich of $10, and that $5.50 goes to the Giants' pocket, pure profit.
Congress is starting to wake up to the movement of low-wage workers demanding an increase in the federal minimum wage. Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan is one of the legislators who is leading the campaign in the House of Representatives. Jesse Russell reports.
Pocan said one of the greatest issues facing the country is the growing income inequality gap.
In the last 40 years, adjusted wages, 90% of Americans have seen an increase of about $59. The top 1% of the top 1% has seen an increase of $18 million. Measured out, that's like 1 inch versus 5 miles of a difference.
Pocan said in addition to raising the minimum wage, he believes giving workers more tools for organizing as a union are fundamental to turning the economy around.
If we can get people back in economically stable position, it overall helps the economy. It's growing the economy from the middle out and the bottom up, which has always been the most sustainable way, and that's what we're proposing.
He said the increase should be between $9 and $11 per hour.
Around the $10 figure seems to be mathematically probably where we should be and where we can probably find the best bump to people to lift people out of poverty, but also make the increase still within a range of where most people really, you know, kind of are paid anyway.
However, Pocan has his doubts that the current Republican-controlled House would be willing to embrace raising the federal minimum.
There's no way this Congress, and we just couldn't pass a farm bill. We've been so unable to do almost anything. But I think it certainly doesn't mean you don't continue to fight for it and talk about it, because the people certainly are with us. And I think we just got to keep agitating.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The wall.
Saw the news this morning, Philadelphia, a sinkhole partially swallowed up a car there in the streets of Philadelphia. No injuries reported, but if you look at the picture, you're looking at a big car up on its nose in the ground. Giant sinkhole opened up. You know, emergency crews responded. No word on what the cause of the sinkhole is, but I think you could probably make the assumption it's an older city. Probably haven't done the needed upgrades to their water and sewage. You know, it kind of eroded away, and boom, down you go. Just like the 42 sinkholes we've had here in the area of Harrisburg over the last year. And I keep going. At some point, sanity will rule. Reinvestment will happen. And we will get a transportation bill that will, one, improve our infrastructure, improve our economic viability, and put people back to work. That's why I've asked our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for LIUNA, to come talk to us a little bit about what's going on the legislative front. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
I heard a nasty rumor, and I'm hoping it's not true. The nasty rumor is the transportation bill dead for the fall.
Well, I happen to think that we may be able to cobble something together, Rick. What I heard as recently as today is that legislative leaders are talking. The chairman of the Transportation Committee, the Republican, is talking to the Democratic leaders, and in the next several weeks they will continue discussions going into September the 23rd in hopes that they could put together a $2.5 billion package. Now, we have been optimistic in the past, and unfortunately nothing has come to fruition. And as long as these natural disasters, if you will, I mean, they're not really disasters, but as long as we have these sinkholes that could become disastrous, I think that the conversations are going to continue. I really believe that we are on the cusp of doing something. But again, I have to be cautiously optimistic because I've heard all this before, Rick. But you know, and again, I'm speaking as recently as today that legislative leaders have been talking, on both sides, at least in the House, and, that the Senate is also interested in doing something. So we're going to cross our fingers, but we have to work awfully hard to let these guys and gals know that this is unacceptable. The inaction is just going to continue to cripple the infrastructure, and heaven forbid a fatality will take place.
But the thing is, how can you not? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, this used to be bipartisan. Just getting to work and back used to be something that everybody agreed on. Or am I wrong here?
No, you're not wrong at all, Rick. I mean, this is called common sense governing, where both parties put down their swords and their shields, and they work towards common ground. But that hasn't happened in Harrisburg for quite some time. And you would think something as innocuous as transportation, infrastructure, something that everybody can agree upon would be simple to negotiate. But that hasn't been the case, because you've got the majority leader, you know, wanting booze for bridges. You know, he wants a quid pro quo with privatization of the state stores, and that's just not going to happen. My understanding is that issue is going to be gone for the fall, and that they need to focus on transportation, and that's why the leaders are talking to each other. The conversations have begun, and you know, hopefully we'll have something hammered out that can be pushed through the legislature in September. Now, I understand that there was a hang-up on $400 million for mass transit in Pittsburgh primarily, and in Philadelphia, of course, and that was taken out of the last bill. And I understand that that's going to be put back on the table simply because there are zero votes on the Democratic side if that $400 million is not put back into the bill. So I'm hoping that these discussions are going to be meaningful in the next several weeks. I know that there's a lull right now in Harrisburg and the legislature is out, but I'm really hoping that this comes to fruition, Rick, because for every $1 billion in investment, that's 27,500 jobs estimated. That's not just me talking. That's the U.S. Department of Transportation's estimate.
So, yeah, I've seen numbers all over. In fact, you know, the one I use is Stephen LaTourette, the Republican from Ohio, the congressman who retired last year.
Yes.
He was quoted as saying 40,000 jobs for every $1 billion of investment. So somewhere in that range, you're still talking a lot of jobs. And getting people back to work and getting that economic activity to happen, and maybe alleviating some traffic down the road. And I saw this new app for my phone. It's called I'm Stuck, the app. Have you seen this?
I have not.
The people at Building America's Future, it's a coalition of supposed, you know, bipartisan. You got Rendell, you've got Schwarzenegger, you got Bloomberg. They've come together and they're working with this Building America's Future and saying, hey, you know, invest in something because we all agree on it. But they've got this app that'll tell you where traffic is and how bad things are. It's pretty neat.
Wow, I'd have to check that out, Rick. And you know, I mean, these are things that people are paying attention to. Obviously, I mean, everybody talks about how bad construction can be and how bad traffic is, you know, what they really need to be talking about is how bad the legislature is, because they're not getting anything done. And so I'm hoping that there's going to be some movement in the next several weeks that is going to stimulate some action from these guys and gals, you know, especially in leadership. And, you know, I'm glad to see that the discussions are taking place. But, again, we've been down this road before, no pun intended, Rick, and you know, nothing has come about. So it's up to us in terms of the listeners and those folks who want to hold their elected leaders accountable. Call them, find out who sits on these transportation committees in the Senate and the House, and urge them to get something done, because I just don't want a tragedy to take place. I'm glad there were no fatalities in Philadelphia, Rick, but I mean, I'm sorry to say it. I mean, we're headed in that direction unless something is done.
Yeah, and if you want to take a look at it, we've got a picture of it on our Facebook page. Just look at Facebook.com/Rick Smith. You know, and I look at this, and one of the things that grabs my attention is, you know, we've in the last, according to the World Economic Forum, as a nation, just a decade ago, we ranked number one in infrastructure.
Wow.
We now rank 14th. The American Society of Civil Engineers has given us a D minus on our infrastructure. There's a problem.
Yes, there is a problem, and it's at the policy level.
Yep.
The policy making and the policy makers, they don't grasp the severity of these issues, and they don't grasp the fact that these are economic drivers as well. I mean, when you have bad roads, that means the goods and services are not going to be provided in a timely fashion. When you're wasting time, you're also wasting money. But they don't understand this, or they just don't want to get it. And the instance of our majority leader, Mike Terzai, I mean, here he is trying to establish a quid pro quo with the state Senate, saying, hey, you send me over privatization of the state stores, and I'll send you over transportation. That's not effective governing. That's bad governing.
Yep.
And, you know, and then we have a governor who sits on the sidelines and just doesn't push anybody to act. This is amazing. You know, I had a friend of mine, Rick, over the weekend tell me, you know, you have a Republican-controlled House, a Republican-controlled Senate, a Republican in the governor's mansion, and you can't get anything accomplished. I mean, they're laughing at us, Rick. I mean, that's what it's come to. In Pennsylvania, particularly with transportation funding.
But I got to tell you, Abe, I got to tell you, with all of the bad stuff that they've proposed, I'm glad nothing's getting done. Because, you know, the bad, is, all of the stuff that I've seen them come forth with, privatization of the liquor store, the lottery, Act 13, all of the stuff, the voter suppression, all of the ALEC-type legislation, all of the wealth class, here's our stuff, go pass it, marching orders, I'm glad a lot of that stuff has failed.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And let me add one other thing, that nothing has been done to hurt the prevailing wage in Pennsylvania as well, and it's still in place. So I'm rejoicing over that because for the third consecutive year, we beat that back, and I think we're going to be able to beat it back in the fall if it rears its ugly head again. So in that respect, you are correct that inaction is better than bad policy. It's just that there's such a lack of leadership right now, proactive leadership, to push something positive and constructive through, because we really need a transportation bill. We need to put people back to work. We need to fix our roads and bridges, and we have to ensure that no family that's going over a bridge is in peril and is in risk of having the bridge collapse and then, heaven forbid, losing someone.
I still think an app, since, you know, Rendell and Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg have an app about traffic, I still think an app warning you of a structurally deficient bridge, like something pop up on your phone and say, call mom, you're going over a bad bridge.
That's absolutely right, Rick. And, you know, tomorrow there's going to be a hearing by the Transportation Committee. Now, I know it's going to be dealing with the turnpike, but I do believe that some of the members are going to ask, When is PennDOT going to be coming out with its revamped list of structurally deficient bridges, particularly those that don't meet the weight limit, where you have to post new weight limits because the bridge has gotten weaker? That's where we are now, Rick. We have bridges that cannot sustain heavy trucks, heavy machinery, heavy equipment, because they're just so dilapidated. I mean, they're in such bad shape, they're going to crumble. They're going to hurt somebody. And that list has to be coming out in the next several weeks. In fact, ironically, the folks who were talking about this were in the Marcellus Shale. I mean, those heavy rigs, those heavy trucks that are going in and tearing up roads and bridges, I mean, they're complaining about this now. So maybe something's going to get done in the next several weeks. You know, squawking at those Republicans on those transportation committees, telling them something's got to get done, guys, because if not, we're not going to be able to extract that gas, we're not going to be able to provide jobs, and then communities are going to suffer as a result of it. I hope that something gets done, because right now we are just in a state of limbo, and again, I'm cautiously optimistic, because those negotiations and those talks have started again, and as recently as today.
Yeah, I mean, the last line, a question I got for you, because, you know, I look at this, and to me, it's a lack of vision.
Yes.
You know, last week I joined in a wellness walk, if you will. It was an anti-violence walk here in Harrisburg that Judge Evans put together here in Harrisburg. You know, anti-violence, you know, want people to stop shooting each other. And he told me as we were walking together that, you know, back in the 70s, he was on the school board. And they were talking about replacing the sewer and the water lines back in the 70s.
Right.
But they couldn't get past the bickering. They couldn't figure out who was going to fund what. So nothing got done. And here we are, you know, 40 years later, nothing's gotten done. And my fear is that we're going to repeat that cycle, and in 10, 20, 30, 40 more years,
yeah,
nothing's going to get done.
That's right, Rick. That's always the danger, because you don't have courageous, proactive leadership out there that's willing to stick its neck out and say, this is wrong, we have to address it now. It's been 16 years since we've had a comprehensive transportation bill in Pennsylvania. We can't wait another 16 years. This is absolutely an outrage. And until people start calling their legislators and demanding action, the status quo is going to continue. That's my biggest concern right now.
Do you think that the transportation came up at the weekend powwow in Bedford? Did you go to the powwow?
I did not. I was not invited, Rick.
$670 a night to stay at the Omni Bedford Resort there.
Oh,
$670 a night. You know, and I'm sure the Republicans on their poverty tour, you know, swung through there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of poor people can afford $670
a night. Absolutely. Yeah, they're lining up at the door. My goodness.
Yeah, to clean the bathroom.
That's awful.
It is, that's absolutely. Awful. Abe, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate
Likewise.
You taking time for us.
You got it, pal. Thank you.
Our good friend Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for LIUNA. A quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Well, finally, hard-right congressional leaders and the Obama White House have agreed that interest rates on student loans should not double to nearly 7% as they let happen early in July. Instead, college students will be billed at a rate that will steadily rise to above 8%. This is progress? Well, yes, in that this year's rate would drop to 3.8%. But for the longer run, obviously not. Even capping the interest rate at 8.25%, as the White House demanded, is too high, for it still saddles students with a crushing debt of some $20,000 to $40,000 for a four-year degree, just as they're getting started on their economic path. But worse, lawmakers are playing small ball, avoiding the big issue. Bickering over percentages shrivels the public debate to its most picayune and meanest point, which our so-called leaders seem to specialize in these days. They focus on the price of everything without grasping the value of anything. And the value of a college education, not only to America's youth, but most significantly to our whole society's economic and democratic future, is clearly established. So the big question we should be asking is this: why isn't higher education free?
As Les Leopold of the Labor Institute notes in a July 2nd alternate piece, for over 150 years, our nation has recognized that tuition-free primary and secondary schools were absolutely vital to the growth and functioning of our Commonwealth. Today, open access to a college degree or other advanced training is as vital to America as a high school diploma has been in our past. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget interest rates. Our young people should not be blocked by a massive debt load from getting the education that they need, but also that all of America needs them to have for our mutual prosperity and democratic strength.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, I love that frame. Well, they're going to get their tax increase. Understand, costs keep going up. Taxes are going to go up. Something, it's going to go up one way or another. It's how you frame it. And I remember the whole 2010 gubernatorial election where, you know, Corbett said, well, I wouldn't be against raising the unemployment insurance, you know that tax on workers. You know, that's a fee. That's not really a tax. So, you know, that's okay. That's okay with the Grover pledge. So I see this story today that the Turnpike is going to be raising its rates again, which, again, to me is a tax increase. But here, again, it's that two-tier system, which, again, I got to think at some point people have got to say enough with and push back on. They're saying if you're an Easy Pass customer, you're going to pay 2% more. If you decide that you're going to pay with cash, it's going to cost you 12% more. So, you know, I've been thinking about this over the past couple of years. If you're paying cash, you're getting seriously screwed. Because, you know, what was it the last time? Was it 20% the last time? And then 20% since that? I mean, this is the sixth consecutive year tolls have increased. And the fourth, in a row that they've been charging people who pay cash more. So we're seeing that divide happening more and more. And what that's meant to do, understand, it's meant to put all those workers out of jobs, make poverty worse, get rid of all those toll takers, get rid of them all. That's what it's meant to do. Understand that. But for me, again, I go back to this, you know, this shifting of, you know, it's a toll increase. It's a tax. Since 2011, cash tolls have risen by 30%. Easy pass rates by 5%. I mean, where's the outrage? Well, you should get an easy pass. My libertarian right-wing lunatic friends, just throwing it out for my tinfoil friends. The easy pass, you know, as well as the silly little store cards and all that other stuff that corporate America throws on us, those are tracking devices. And I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but there are numerous reports of the video, the street cameras that, you know, they put at red lights or in construction zones. Those are tracking people and keeping records of license plates. Do you not think that the Easy Pass keeps a record of where you go? So that idea, and this is, you know, this is long-term down the road thinking. One of the great things about this country are the open borders. We can go to any state we want and go wherever we want, and nobody's supposedly tracking us until Easy Pass, until transponders, until Fast Pass, or, you know, all the states have their own little different programs. What happens when they tie all that together? And at some point it happens. at some point you will have electronic eye in the sky everywhere. Now, I'm not trying to sound conspiratorial. I'm just saying what is. Now, I was explaining to my daughter that, you know, the other day that, you know, the FaceTime on my cell phone, that I can sit and look at my wife while we're talking on the phone. I can see her in my little screen, and we're talking to each other in real time. That was a fantasy when I was her age. And that wasn't that long ago. And that all of those things that I read in the Ray Bradbury stories and all of the sci-fi books that I read as a kid, that stuff's coming true. And the very real tracking, the very real control mechanisms we're seeing put in place. Just a thought. Anyway, a new documentary coming out about JFK. Another theory. But this one claims that the president was shot twice. Two different shooters. Now, a lot of people have thought, well, you know, the grassy knoll. It wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. It was somebody in the grassy knoll. This new one, called The Smoking Gun, it claims that, and, you know, this is one I've never heard before. This is new, and, you know, a bunch of theories out there came from the storm drain, came from behind, came from, you know, a different building. We were in Dealey Plaza, and, you know, a lot smaller than it looks on the films. This one is saying they know who the shooter is. The shooter, they claim, is a guy named George Hickey. George Hickey was a Secret Service agent. They claim that George was a poorly trained agent with the AR-15. Wasn't properly trained with it, but, you know, was holding the gun, loaded, ready. Somehow the gun went off. And one of the agents who was there with him said, you know, well, he believes that Hickey accidentally pulled the trigger when the car came to an abrupt stop after Oswald shot at the president. Seems plausible, possible. And they also say that, well, the government knew about it and covered it up. So you think about it. It's going to the special, The Smoking Gun, is going to be on the Reels channel on November 3rd. I'm going to watch it. Why not? I suggest you do, too. I'm sure it'll be interesting. I don't know that it's accurate, but it'll be interesting to see. I'm going to take a quick break here. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone, email rick@ricksmithshow.com. Right back after this. We got to get older right. We got to do it today.
Listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The 500 concession stand workers at the San Francisco Giants AT&T ballpark want fair wage increases, job security, and decent health care. But they had to stage a one-day strike to press those very reasonable demands. Unite Here Local 2 represents the workers. The Giants use contractor Center Plate to run the concession stands. Patricia Ramirez says the workers are just after a fair deal.
Some of the things that we're fighting for is our job security, our health benefits, our wages, pensions, you know, things that we need every day to live on here in this expensive Bay Area.
Ramirez says the Giants need to take responsibility for the way the concessions workers are treated. She wants them to step up and help the workers get a fair deal.
The Giants keep saying that the contract dispute is between Center Plate and local too, and it has nothing to do with the Giants, but that is not true at all. I mean, the Giants are the ones who, say, for instance, we have a sandwich of $10, and that $5.50 goes to Giants' pocket, pure profit.
Congress is starting to wake up to the movement of low-wage workers demanding an increase in the federal minimum wage. Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan is one of the legislators who is leading the campaign in the House of Representatives. Jesse Russell reports.
Pocan said one of the greatest issues facing the country is the growing income inequality gap.
In the last 40 years, adjusted wages, 90% of Americans have seen an increase of about $59. The top 1% of the top 1% has seen an increase of $18 million. Measured out, that's like 1 inch versus 5 miles of a difference.
Pocan said in addition to raising the minimum wage, he believes giving workers more tools for organizing as a union are fundamental to turning the economy around.
If we can get people back in economically stable position, it overall helps the economy. It's growing the economy from the middle out and the bottom up, which has always been the most sustainable way, and that's what we're proposing.
He said the increase should be between $9 and $11 per hour.
Around the $10 figure seems to be mathematically probably where we should be and where we can probably find the best bump to people to lift people out of poverty, but also make the increase still within a range of where most people really, you know, kind of are paid anyway.
However, Pocan has his doubts that the current Republican-controlled House would be willing to embrace raising the federal minimum.
There's no way this Congress, and we just couldn't pass a farm bill. We've been so unable to do almost anything. But I think it certainly doesn't mean you don't continue to fight for it and talk about it, because the people certainly are with us. And I think we just got to keep agitating.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the loving cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned.
Oh, it's kind of difficult to burn the house down when it's underwater. And I look at the city of Richmond, California, which 46%, according to this press release, 46% of all residential mortgages in the city are still underwater. And the city is taking an unprecedented step towards helping those struggling homeowners. And here to talk a little bit about this, Kevin Whalen. He's campaign director for Home Defenders League, homedefendersleague.org, the website. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Yeah, I look at this story. 46% of all residential mortgage holders in the city are underwater. That's an enormous number.
It's an enormous number, and there are many communities in many states, in California, in Arizona, and Nevada, other hard-hit states where, you know, they tell us, and if you read the business press, that this crisis is over, but with half or more people underwater, it's a crisis that's obviously very much underway and not going to get any better unless people take some action to fix it.
Yeah, I go back to when the collapse happened in 2008, and I did a little history, a little research of history, and came back, went back to the Home Ownership Loan Corporation under FDR, where they actually bought up the mortgages that were underwater, reduced the principal a little bit, low interest loans, longer period of time, kept people in their homes as best they could. We didn't really do that, did we?
No. The reason you see individual cities needing to take action, like Richmond very boldly and bravely did today, is that the federal government has failed to step in, and as quickly as they acted to save banks and Wall Street, there's been foot dragging would be the kindest word for moving forward any solution that would help homeowners and the country as a whole get back on track. And people are just out of time waiting for something to happen, pleading, demanding, protesting, and need to start taking some kind of action at the local level.
So walk me through what the city of Richmond did, because, you know, one of the things that I've often advocated for us. I look at cities like Detroit, and when we did our labor history tour, we went through Detroit, where there are just communities that are completely abandoned. And I go, who owns these houses? Why can't the city say, you know what, if you can't put someone in this house, we're not going to let it be abandoned. We're going to take it through eminent domain if we have to and make sure that we can get people in there, or we're going to tear them down and open up these communities. Walk me through what the city of Richmond did.
Yeah, it's interesting because what the city of Richmond did is a little different and a little more novel than that. Actually, taking abandoned houses would be a more traditional use of eminent domain. But here it's really stepping in to do what the federal government or banks themselves should have done a long time ago and prevent people from losing their house and prevent people from from houses from becoming vacant and all the costs that are associated with that. So what the city of Richmond did today was send letters, actually to a bunch of servicers, to a bunch of the banks that collect on these underwater mortgages on the behalf of groups of investors that own them, and because of all the ways that Wall Street sliced and diced and sold parts of our mortgages back to each other, it can be a complex question of who really owns it.
Right.
But what they said is, we'll take these loans off your hands. We'll pay you the fair market value for them, the same thing that you would pay when you're busy buying them and selling them to each other, which is, of course, not 100 cents on the dollar when they swap them and sell them. And we're going to then help refinance these loans. We're going to work with another group of private investors that are willing to refinance the loans for what houses are actually worth now, so that the homeowner is there in their home the whole time. There's nothing changing about who's there. But they end up with a new mortgage where they, instead of being $100,000 or $200,000 underwater in a lot of cases, have some home equity.
And a form of, you're talking about a basic form of principal reduction.
That's right. It's the principal reduction that people have been fighting for and that everybody has understood throughout this crisis is the way to make it make sense for people to pay on their homes and not just be renting from the banks for the rest of their lives, and to put tons of money back into local economies, right? If people aren't paying on a principal on a loan they can't afford, they'd have more money to spend on local businesses.
Right.
But despite, you know, fighting like tigers for it, precious little have happened. So this is a way that communities can do principal reduction, at least for some loans, at the local level.
Because I look at it, and I got to be honest, I've thought about this. Let's say you bought a house for $200,000. The collapse happened. It's now worth $100,000. What keeps you in that house?
You know, and if you're a bank or a big company that's in that situation and operate purely on business principles, what you do is either walk away or banks all the time. In fact, there's a great segment about the Mortgage Bankers Association's own headquarters will say, hey, this doesn't make sense anymore, and renegotiate it. But as homeowners, we want to stay in the house where we've been raising our families. We want to make good on our debts and pay our bills and not have our credit ruined. So people do keep paying. But, you know, when the companies value these loans and sell them back and forth to each other, they understand that a house that's, you know, way underwater is not worth the money they're trying to collect on it. And in the end, it's just not going to make sense for people to pay on loans that are based on a real estate bubble that, you know, no individual homeowner created. The Wall Street banks created and have been paid in full and, you know, over and over again for any damages they suffered. And we need to get principal back down to what the houses are really worth so people can make payments that make sense and they can afford.
This sounds like an excellent plan, but I guess the question then becomes is, okay, you're going to buy the houses up at retail at current market value. Where are you going to get the money from?
Well, so there are other investors who are willing to step in, and they think they can make a profit doing this because you're going to buy the loans at what the loans are really worth, what they would trade for on the secondary market, and write a new loan that reflects the actual value of the house and leave the homeowner with some principal. And so there's a way that private investors, and there's some groups of private investors that have stepped forward and say they want to do this, and they'll help cities work it out. So that, in fact, this could all work. One of the things about Richmond sending out these offers today is that they said, if necessary, they'll use eminent domain to make the servicers sell these loans.
You got to have the stick there.
But it could actually be a decent business decision. If they have these troubled loans, really it's because it's too complicated to figure out who the hell owns them that they haven't done it yet. It may be very well that some of the servicers step forward and say, yeah, that's fine, you pay us what it's worth. And so it could actually make sense, you know, once the stick sort of focuses their attention on this matter.
So do you think this could be the way forward for many communities across the country, or is this just unique to Richmond?
It's not unique to Richmond. I know there's other communities that are looking at it and considering it, starting with some others in California and Las Vegas, but a lot more are looking into it, and I suspect a lot more will follow. It's not a solution to the whole underwater crisis. Only certain types of loans fit into this, but it's important because it's a solution that communities can start to do on their own without having to plead with or cajole either the big banks or the federal government to take action that they've been unwilling to take so far. And I think in doing that, seeing local communities use democracy to take control of their economic future frightens Wall Street so badly. They're just freaking out, and I think that puts some more pressure on them to solve the problem on a national level.
Yeah, because I've been saying for a while, you know, when it first came up to me, this idea of using eminent domain, you know, I was kind of, let me think this through. But once I worked it through in my head, if the banks aren't going to move the houses, if they're going to sit there abandoned, I look at my hometown of Cleveland where there are neighborhoods that, you know, every other house is empty. I think the city has a responsibility more than anything to make sure that the community as a whole is healthy and vibrant. And by allowing these banks to just let these places sit and decay, thus bringing down the entire neighborhood, is unacceptable.
It hurts everybody. And, you know, an empty house brings down the value of the houses around it. It costs taxpayer money. And rather than wait till, you know, so if half the houses are underwater in Richmond, should they wait till half are empty and then start finding a solution? When there's a you know, the houses are filled right now with people that can and want to pay on a reasonable mortgage based on what the house is really worth. So an ounce of prevention certainly is, you know, makes a lot of sense, and is a very strong argument that that's part of the public good.
Yeah, I'm with you. And as you guys there at Home Defenders League, one of the national organizations fighting against foreclosures, you know, this is something you guys have kind of been advocating for a while, right?
We have. We've been talking about it for a while because it is something that communities can do to take matters into their own hands on the local level. And while we also, you know, go to D.C. and risk arrest demanding that the banks finally be held accountable by the Justice Department or fight to get new leadership at the agencies that could really allow or do principal reduction, people need some solutions that they can actually enact in their community where they live, and this is one of them. You know, the fact that it seems to spread the idea that people can take their future into their hands and that uniquely terrifies Wall Street just is all the better.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But I look at this and I go, you know, I look at the banks and I look at, you know, there was just a story the other day that said the financial industry is now, you know, right up at the top of the S&P 500 and all of this. The financial industry is back and fat and happy and everything's wonderful there. But here we are, communities like Richmond, 46% of the people who have mortgages still underwater. We've done very well by some, the handfuls, but the vast majority of people, I think, have been sold out on this. And I'm glad to see that something's being done to at least give folks a fighting shot at the bottom.
I appreciate your attention to this issue as always. There's it's fashionable for people that report in the business section or the real estate section to say, oh, home prices went up in some places and so the crisis is over, everything's great now. And, you know, everything's great if you're sitting in your mansion collecting money that was fueled by the bailout. But the fact is home prices are going up in a lot of places where speculators are buying up abandoned houses that families have lost, and families are without a place to live, and whole communities are without the tax revenue that went into occupied houses and paying for abandoned houses. And that doesn't feel like a recovery to the, you know, 99 or 99.9% of us.
Yeah, I look at this, and when I first read the press release, I'm thinking, well, maybe the city was going to float a bond because the cities can borrow money at much lower rates than people can. But you know, this seems like a Wall Street kind of solution to a degree. Or am I misreading that?
Right. There's private money that they can leverage because it does make sense to rate people a mortgage on a loan that they can actually store that reflects the principal of their house. So the city doesn't have the capital to, doesn't need to have the capital to float bonds for all the mortgages in their city. And, you know, that's true with any, almost any solution to the mortgage crisis that involves fairer loans. When we fight for principal reduction or when we have gone out and fought for fair loans in communities of color that have been redlined previously, there's still the capitalist system and loans and banks involved. People just want the chance to pay their mortgage and live in their home on fair and reasonable terms. And the banks that got a big break seem to have a problem with that.
No. I'm glad to see something being done, and I appreciate you coming and talking to us and telling us what's going on, Kevin. I appreciate the time.
Always appreciate being on your show. Hope we can do it again soon.
Thanks so much, Kevin Whelan, campaign director for Home Defenders League. If you want more information about the Home Defenders League, homedefendersleague.org, the website, just go to ricksmithshow.com and click on Kevin's name, and it'll take you right there as well. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Well, finally, hard right congressional leaders and the Obama White House have agreed that interest rates on student loans should not double to nearly 7% as they let happen early in July. Instead, college students will be billed at a rate that will steadily rise to above 8%. This is progress? Well, yes, in that this year's rate would drop to 3.8%. But for the longer run, obviously not. Even capping the interest rate at 8.25%, as the White House demanded, is too high, for it still saddles students with a crushing debt of some $20,000 to $40,000 for a four-year degree, just as they're getting started on their economic path. But worse, lawmakers are playing small ball, avoiding the big issue. Bickering over percentages shrivels the public debate to its most picayune and meanest point, which our so-called leaders seem to specialize in these days. They focus on the price of everything without grasping the value of anything, and the value of a college education not only to America's youth, but most significantly to our whole society's economic and democratic future, is clearly established. So the big question we should be asking is this. Why isn't higher education free? As Les Leopold of the Labor Institute notes in a July 2nd alternate piece, for over 150 years, our nation has recognized that tuition-free primary and secondary schools were absolutely vital to the growth and functioning of our Commonwealth. Today, open access to a college degree or other advanced training is as vital to America as a high school diploma has been in our past. This is Jim Hightower saying, forget interest rates. Our young people should not be blocked by a massive debt load from getting the education that they need, but also that all of America needs them to have for our mutual prosperity and democratic strength.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and it won't hurt at
1-888-520. Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So today, back in 1999, United Airlines agreed to offer domestic partner benefits to employees and retirees worldwide. You look at this and you go, well, you know, there might be hope. The state of Pennsylvania, you had a guy in Montgomery County saying, well, you know, we're going to issue a same-sex marriage license to people who ask for it. And here in the area, a couple of people got married because of that, which sent the Republicans into a tizzy. Basically Daryl Metcalf, or Mad Cow, as I like to call him. Basically a ranting hissy fit of, it's not legal, it's not legal, it's not legal. He said it's not legal. I tend to disagree. I tend to go to that equal protection to the law thing, that we all have, should have the same rights. Anyway, a couple of people here in Harrisburg were married over the weekend at the Pride Festival of Central PA. I wasn't invited, but the ceremony happened, and I see, and Senator Leach had officiated a ceremony out in Montgomery County as well. It's kind of interesting that the message is kind of, the antis are kind of being put back, because I think most people wake up and realize, you know what, it is an equal protection thing. Even the Pope has said he doesn't judge gay priests, which has sent the Catholic world into a hissy fit. And you got the Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, saying no. He didn't say anything that isn't real. It's still a sin. The acts are a sin. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's a very staunch Catholic, who gave me the exact same line, which is, it's not a sin to be a homosexual. It's a sin to do it. And I said, well, hold on. Because I grew up Catholic, and I was always told it's a bunch of sins. The thought of it was a sin. So are we changing the Catholic faith that I grew up under? That just thinking about it, when you were having lustful thoughts, I don't care about anything. About a bicycle, about the girl across the street, about food, or anything, any of that stuff, any of the impure thoughts. That was a sin, as far as I remember. Maybe someone can correct me, but as a kid, that was part of it. It was all that covet thing. It wasn't the actual taking, because thou shalt not steal, obviously not. It wasn't the going after and getting. It was the thinking. And I've always said coveting is how our economy, works. You see the neighbor up the street with the new car, and you go, wow, I like that car. I'm going to go get me a new car because I like that. Or, you see the never mind. You see the not going there. Decided not. Anyway, the Cardinal said no. The Pope hasn't said anything outside of the norm, so he's not changed religious doctrine. And I gotta be honest, I'm watching this Pope, and I'll be honest about it. I didn't make any judgments. He has surprised me. This we don't judge thing. What do you want? Catholics, that's what I, yeah. People not judging each other, really? I always thought, that's, and my Catholic friend said, no, we don't do that anymore. There's if you sin, then it's forgiven, and it's forgotten. And I'm going, really? I always thought that there was a ledger. He got up to the pearly gates, and Pete pulled out the, St. Pete pulled out the, okay, on the 12th, you did this, atone for that. No, evidently not. So maybe there's hope for me yet. Maybe I will be returning to the flock, because this guy, we don't judge, take care of the poor, health care for people, give people a living wage, walking among the people, doing what Jesus, washing people's feet, actually being a humble a humble servant actually saying that we should be decent human beings? What are you talking about? I'm worried for him. He better get in the Pope mobile because it's crazy talk. It's crazy talk that people should, you know, be able to exist. It's crazy talk that we should raise wages for people so that they can feed their family. Crazy talk that we shouldn't be judging each other. What? It's crazy talk. So my Republican friends will be very happy to know that Governor Corbett and the Republicans here in the state of Pennsylvania have not let you down. The health, and I'm going, you know, the health department, the health agency, they're the ones who filed suit. How exactly, you know, maybe I'm just confused, but how exactly does the health department play into marriage? Maybe if the health department had anything that they would do, maybe just, here's a thought. I remember when I got married back in 1992, I drove to Mercer County, Pennsylvania to get a marriage license. And I took it back to Ohio where I lived in Cleveland, and I went to my doctor, and the doctor said, "You what? You have to get a gonorrhea test? What century are we in?" Because evidently the state of Pennsylvania mandates that you have to have a gonorrhea test. AIDS, herpes, any of that other stuff? No, never mind that. Gonorrhea, yes. So if the health department really wanted to do something to protect people's health, maybe change the testing. You know, gonorrhea is curable. We can fix that. HIV, not so much. Herpes, never. It's like luggage. You're going to keep that forever. Just a thought. I don't know why they're delving into the marriage argument. Maybe on a mental health level, which, you know, some people say that there are some mental health benefits to being married. I don't know. But I'm just curious why they chose that department, that section of our government, other than the attorney general who says she's not going to do it. Just throwing that out there for quick consideration. And, you know, for me, I go back to my view on same-sex marriage, which I guess is different than most people. There obviously is the argument that, you know, it's equal rights under the law and the Constitution and all of that stuff, that we should treat everybody as equals and you give no one special treatment. You know, just throwing that out there for my constitutionalists, my original intenters. But the other part of this is, you know, look, I'm not going to protect you from yourself. Well, I know a lot of very unhappy married people that wish they had never gotten married. If you want to subject yourself to that, God bless you. Jump right on in, both feet. You want to end up giving up half your stuff if things go south, you know, God bless you. Whatever we can do to help you out. And for my friends who hate the act, because, you know, I have some of my Catholic friends who say it's the act that the sin. It's not being homosexual. It's that act. The best way to stop the act, you got it. Get married. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, BerkSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this with Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around.
Seven families, but I found seven farms. I think about my grandpa, my neighbors and my name. It's a nice feel like I
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
All right, almost.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. The big news today, obviously, Bradley Manning, the decision. I'm interested tomorrow what's going to be the sentence, the punishment, how many years this kid's going to spend in prison for. I got to be honest with you, doing what I think was a good thing, just my view. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and here in the U.S. I got Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, the big verdict today.
Yes, guilty on 19 of the 22 counts against him. I heard Michael Ratner, actually, Ellen Ratner's brother, doing a press conference. He's Julian Assange's defense attorney. He said today this is a good thing because Manning was acquitted of the biggest charge against him, the one that carried a life sentence. That's aiding the enemy. But yet, much of the language that's in that charge is actually in another one of the charges that he was found guilty of. That's the charge of, quote, wrongfully and wantonly, end quote, causing the intelligence that he leaked to be published with the knowledge that it was going to be available to the enemy. This is kind of a weird question that's come up in this trial.
You mean the people? You mean people like you and me? Enemy.
Right. It's to make something accessible on the internet, the same as emailing it to Al Qaeda. And the sort of answer I think we got from the guilty charge on wrongfully and wantonly, distributing something that would knowingly fall into the hands of our enemies is that we are kind of viewing it like that.
Yeah, so you better watch out what you say here because you could be aiding and abetting or you could be letting information out to the enemy.
Exactly that. I think people, the ACLU, for example, has been really opposed to this. They've actually, very principled in their opposition, saying they don't like it when the government uses the Espionage Act to go after leaks to the media. I think people who were, looking at this trial result and saying they got the assurances they need from the government are really not looking at the right facts here. There is no assurance here that the government is not going to continue using the Espionage Act against the, similar Bradley Mannings in the future. So they may have not brought the biggest charge against him, but they certainly threw a guilty verdict on him for one count that I think still has the potential to quiet the public advocacy press, if you will.
Well, I got to be honest with you. What this kid's gone through over the last 3 years and what he's going to go through in the coming years, because I had said yesterday I think, they're going to make an example out of him, and someone pointed out they already have. I mean, when you lock somebody away basically in solitary confinement, and make them stand 20 hours a day and all of the things that they've done, I think that's deterrent enough.
Right. It's the United Nations that even characterized his treatment as being, inhuman. He was forced to strip naked, among other things. This was described as torture by the United Nations. And he spent 1,187 days in custody before this trial began. That was described by the judge who gave him the verdict in this case as not being an unusually long time to wait before receiving a trial, though I think that still raises eyebrows.
3 years? What happened to that right to a speedy trial thing that's in that piece of paper they love talking about?
Well, they're going to, you know, she gave him 120 days of reduced sentence because of that extremely long period of time. You know, giving back a tenth of the time he's been in custody seems very inadequate to me.
So he's going to do upwards of 130 years, but we'll give you 120 days back. Was that what you're saying?
Yes, plus the 1187 he already spent. But, I mean, those are just a small number of days compared to 130 years. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the inside? What are you hearing? Because Ellen yesterday said she thought he was going to get like 20 years. I don't know. I'm thinking substantially longer than that. I mean, that's just my uneducated, my view on it. Is there any inside thoughts on this?
I don't have any more specific insights. I would tend to think it's going to be longer than that, more in the ballpark of about 50 years that this guy will be released, long after his middle age years. I think they probably rightfully see him as someone they'd be worried about granting too many interviews and writing too many books, while some of the structures that were in existence at the time of these leaks, are still a part of the security establishment. I think they'll try to keep him away for as long as possible.
Now, I got to be honest, I'm of the open, transparent government mentality. If the things that he leaked out were out when they should have been, maybe we wouldn't have gotten ourselves deeper and deeper into the things we did in the Middle East.
Yeah, we'll see. He was found not guilty of one specific charge, which was the release of that video showing a helicopter attack against a group of innocent civilians in Iraq, which included two Reuters journalists. So to some degree, the verdict, if you look at it, one light, did acknowledge that there were some things that, were in the files that he released that were important to be publicized. But the general picture, I think, again, here is that they are trying to send a warning shot across the bow of anyone who's thinking about doing this in the future. And many people, believe that's not a good thing, not a good standard to set.
I don't think so either. And I'm interested to see what they end up doing with Mr. Snowden as well. And, I look at the Middle East, and right now, here we are, still in chaos. I guess a bunch of prison breaks recently.
That's right. Last week, you may have talked about it, there was a prison break in Baghdad at the Abu Ghraib prison, the infamous facility once overseen by the United States. In that attack, 500 al-Qaeda members, mid- and high-level officers in the al-Qaeda system in Iraq, were freed, essentially. These are people who were rounded up during the surge. These are the terms that have almost drifted out of our memory, but were so much a part of the political discourse a few years ago. A senior intelligence official was quoted as saying, "We lost track of everyone in this type of raid." Al-Qaeda affiliate in Iraq has been planning a year-long operation designed to replenish the ranks of their leadership in the country. They sent a few dozen heavily armed people into the prison there, probably had the help of the prison guards to release these figures. And we're looking at a very porous Middle East right now. So, the border specifically with Syria is one of the loosest around. And there are already numerous terrorist groups with known ties to al-Qaeda operating in Syria, including al-Nusra, and al-Qaeda in Iraq, which both of those joined up together to create, essentially a united front. So there is a lot of fear that these fighters, in the coming weeks are going to head up to Syria, begin to take on roles of leadership within al-Qaeda in that country, and are going to be, essentially fighting the cause that the U.S. supports to some extent in Syria, trying to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. But I think we'd be skeptical about, about sending weapons into that kind of situation where we have so many leaders of al-Qaeda in a neighboring country ready to take up those arms and use them for the time being in a conflict that, once it's all said and done, may not be achieving any of our strategic goals in the long term.
But end up arming our enemies. And, you go back to the whole starting of bin Laden and how he got his start by us going, "Here, have some guns. Go fight the Russians, please."
The cycle does not end, and it doesn't look like it's about to end either.
I see more talks in the Middle East. The peace talks have resumed. And I go, at some point, doesn't this ever end? And when will we stop talking about the Israel-Palestinian negotiations? Because nothing ever seems to get done.
Well, not for the next few months. These are 9 months peace talks. So anyone hoping to see some quick action and any sort of agreement announced in the next few days is going to be out of luck. He said this afternoon that the two parties will meet again in about 2 weeks. It's either going to be in Israel or in the Palestinian territory. There's reason to be skeptical here, of course. There are some indications that these governments, both in Israel and Palestine, are taking this a little more seriously than in the past. The Israeli cabinet met on Sunday, and they passed a motion by a pretty large margin, which said that a referendum of everyone in Israel will be needed in order to implement any peace plan that is agreed to in these talks. That's both a good thing and a bad thing if you want an agreement. On one hand, it might be easier to win over negotiators who are looking desperately to be the heroes of a settlement.
Right.
And on the other hand, though, I think it's good that something is not going to be rushed through that people of these countries don't agree with. I think you want as many people on both sides to feel like they're a part of the process. And at least in Israel, there will be a vote before anything in these talks that is agreed to will ever be put into practice.
I mean, my entire life, I mean, we've been having these meetings and photo ops and, oh, we have a great accord and we've got the agreement and handshakes and pictures. I remember Carter and Sadat and Arafat and all of them, you know, shaking, hey, patting each other out with nothing.
We'll see. Now that the photo ops, the scheduled photo ops are over in Washington, I would almost think the best thing that could happen is silence. John Kerry has said repeatedly that the one thing that could derail these talks is leaders on either side being too public about stating what their sticking points are.
Right.
So, you know, from our position in the media, it may be a little unfortunate and may require some real digging, but I think, you know, sort of radio silence over the next few months, giving these people room to negotiate might be good news.
Yeah.
We're hearing too many proclamations from either side like we have over the past few days. It's a bad sign, I think.
Yeah. Let's move along. Big news on Monday. The Pope, I don't know if you followed this, but the Pope came out and said that it's not his job to judge priests for their sexual orientation. Everybody, oh, wow, hey, amazing Pope. I got to be honest with you. He keeps talking crazy, you know, like not judging people and, you know, helping the poor and taking care of the sick and, you know, all of that stuff. Somebody's gonna bump him off, especially with no Pope mobile.
You know,
crazy talk. Not being able to judge, crazy talk, living wage, crazy talk, take care of your neighbors and your crazy.
We will see. On certain points, he's certainly being a good PR spokesperson for a church that has been turning up in the headlines for all the wrong reasons over the past few years. But when it really comes to moving the masses, the Catholic masses around the world toward more inclusive policies, I think the Pope is way out in front of most people on this.
Yeah, I told a buddy of mine today who's a big Catholic, and I said, he keeps this up. I may actually consider possibly thinking about going back to the Catholic Church, even after all the years of beatings and repression that I suffered as a child.
Hey, I think the church may have finally realized it's good to have someone, leading their communications team effectively that is a little bit preaching a more inclusive message. But again, I think it's going to be an uphill battle, especially when you see the statistics coming out of Europe about the numbers of people that are shedding from the rosters of churches. They're really, going against the tides on this, trying to become inclusive at a relatively late date.
Yeah, well, I think people are turning away from God Incorporated. I think the whole business of religion is turning people away. I know a lot of folks that I know. It's that corporate part of it. You know, when I was a kid, I mean, the church used to call on Mondays, where's the money that was supposed to be in the plate? There's no money in the plate. And my mother would go, there's no food in the cupboards.
There you go.
No money in the plate. But it is what it is. Speaking of money, Southwest Airlines busted ripping people off. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Their spokespeople were very quick to say that, they were responsible for no wrongdoing. But essentially what happened here is the Department of Transportation, which is tasked with implementing a law that was actually brought about during the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's inception. So you can thank Elizabeth Warren and others for that. Mm-hmm. This is a law that says that an airline basically has to state all the fees and taxes that are included in fares. and that when they say there's a deal for certain seats at a certain price, they have to make them available. It seems pretty straightforward to me, but apparently in January, Southwest was advertising some special $100 tickets and some $50 tickets between Dallas and Missouri, and they didn't make available any seats at the advertised rate. So, you know, duping people into thinking there was a sale going on and then not actually, you know, offering any sale tickets. And they were fined $200,000 today, which is a pretty high amount for this law. And then, you know, seems to indicate a willingness for the consumer financial laws to be able to actually be implemented and to go after corporations that are, you know, engaging in deceptive practices.
See, that's exactly why the Republicans didn't want it. The party of bait and switch, that's exactly the reason they don't want it.
Well, you know, $200,000 isn't enough to break the bank here, but it's much larger than a $65,000 fine against Orbit here this year. So, again, it looks like the fees are increasing. The intensity of these, you know, investigations into malpractice seems to be, you know, increasing.
Okay.
So, good signs on the consumer side of it.
Good. And while we're on the Southwest thing, maybe we could take a flight to the Congo. What the hell's going on there?
Oh, you know, thousands of miles away, a brand new, you know, era has begun for the United Nations, or at least it will in about 48 hours when the first offensive brigade goes online. You know, as many people may have remembered, from all the documentaries and fictional accounts of the Rwandan genocide, UN troops essentially in the past had to be fired upon in order to return fire. Beginning in 2 days, their first offensive brigade consisting of 3,000 people will now have the right to use lethal force against rebels in the area who have refused to disarm. This is a major turning point in the conflict in the country that has involved a group of rebels called the M23, who are suspected of receiving support from the Rwandan government. So we'll see how this works. They've told rebels to disarm in 2 days, or else they will be. The script is unwritten on this. This is really the beginning of something brand new for the UN. And if it works, I wouldn't be surprised to see it used elsewhere, in addition to the use of surveillance drones, which is the new UN program. If it fails, I think we'll see the UN go very quickly back to its old way of doing things, which didn't work particularly well in the past, but at least avoided them opening fire on people in conflicts that ultimately turned for the worst.
Well, we shall see. Interesting. And finally, the president, as we talked about earlier, the president, he's made his way to Chattanooga, Tennessee, the Amazon warehouse where, you know, most of the jobs are temporary, through temp agencies with low pay and no benefits. And that's the job of the future.
Apparently, this is the company that has had worker strikes around the country the past few months. Obama was there to say that that Amazon is the type of business that could really benefit from a broad investment infrastructure. You know, essentially, if you pave the road, then the Amazon truck carrying your items with free shipping will be able to get to you faster. Maybe this is the appeal that will sell Americans on, you know, a renewal of infrastructure funding. But as you pointed out in your sarcasm, I think there are a lot of people who are saying Amazon is not necessarily the business we want to be planning our economy around. But Obama didn't do that. He basically said today he's unveiling what he calls his new grand bargain: lower the corporate income tax, the corporate tax rate, and use the money to fund job creation projects and infrastructure investments. I think as much as the president thinks this is a new proposal, thinks it might be able to unlock the gridlock of Washington, ultimately, Republicans are already saying this is just another tax and spend program, so he'll probably be met by the same opposition he's faced in the previous
years. No matter how much of what the Republicans want, Obama is willing to give them, it's never going to be enough. Never.
The statements in opposition to his plan were out way too quickly. And there was one story I read today saying that lawmakers on Capitol Hill were getting calls from the White House yesterday saying they were going to announce this. They never called them back to confirm, I'm sure. They got the voicemail and then started writing their press releases instead of actually engaging in a dialogue about these programs. It looks, again, like another non-starter in Washington on the spending front.
Well, I mean, like I said earlier, I mean, the reality is Mitch McConnell came out and said, well, you know, it's a one-sided deal. Lacks meaningful bipartisan input. And I'm going, but hold on. You're the people who put your fingers in your ear, scream la, 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 la. No, we don't want everything. We want everything we want, not just 90% of it.
I can't argue with you too much. It looks like, you know, the Republican rebuttal to this is going to be the nail in the coffin. Again, it comes down to the people like Mitch McConnell deciding whether or not there is progress at all on legislation like this. And as much as the president wants a restart, he wants to see meaningful progress on the spending changes and tax reform. It doesn't look like it's going to happen, at least in this push.
I mean, he's offering repatriation. That's what they wanted. And he's not even he's calling it a transition fee. So we're just going to take it's not even just a little transition fee, which I guarantee is going to be nowhere near what we need to build roads and bridges. But he's actually thrown it back on the table. Well, repatriate all that money that we've allowed you to store over. Instead of saying, you know what, we're just doing away with it. We're going to tax you on it no matter what.
Well, again, it seems I really couldn't even suggest to the president what kind of things he would offer next in his proposals to try to get the Republicans to move on this.
You're not going to get them to move on anything, Loop. You have to go out there. I like the idea that he's out giving speeches. You've got to be bold. And this grand bargain, yeah, it's a nice title, but it's kind of weak. I mean, when you're talking about we're going to give more tax breaks, we're going to have more business investment, we're going to let them repatriate, we're going to do all of this stuff to pander the business as we've been doing, and it hasn't been working, but we're going to do more of what isn't working, just seems to me to be kind of not so grand.
Well, yes, we've seen over the past few years that the language of a grand bargain is not necessarily the framework that allows anything to happen. The added pressure of deadlines and temporary extensions on legislation are evidently not enough to get anyone in Washington to get moving. So I don't think, unfortunately, the language here will be enough to tip the scale.
Yeah, this is where voters have to vote the bums out and get people in who have some vision and really and give a rat's behind about the country and the direction that we're going. Just my view on it. Luke, it's always great talking with you, brother. I appreciate the time.
Take it easy, Rick. Thanks.
Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
I miss the Herman Cain train. And I know you can probably hear him. I think he took over. Didn't he take over for Neil Bortz on a couple of the stations that Bortz was on when he bailed with his big paycheck? I can't imagine, you know, listening to him read there how that must work its way out. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So a little more fun with guns today. Another shooting in the Harrisburg area. Also, the reports today from Harrisburg police said that they think they came out with an AK-47, a 48 caliber handgun, and 1,300 bags of heroin. And when I was reading through the story, 1,300 bags of heroin, they say street value of about $13,000, which means each little bag is 10 bucks. And I'm sitting here thinking, going, you know, 1,300 transactions at 10 bucks a piece, that almost doesn't seem worth it. I mean, it really doesn't seem, and it's a strain of heroin they think they found called Die Happy, which I don't know why in the hell you would want to take anything that says die in it, but it is what it is. I found it interesting also in the article that they were talking about the cuts to the police departments and the pay for the police, and I found out that an officer trainee in the city of Harrisburg is $46,000 a year. And for, a full patrolman, $61,000 a year. And I'm going, there is no way for $61,000 a year I would put up with the danger, the risk, all of the, just nope, not happening. Not for that. Just the shootings and the nonsense, no, ain't happening. Also, more fun with guns. Remember the guy who went to the North Middleton firing range? Which is just down the road from my house a little bit. Someone killed him for his gun. Turns out it was a prison guard. The prison guard who actually had the gun that the lawyer from Enola was killed for, he was sentenced to 11 to 23 months in jail, two counts of receiving stolen property, which he pled guilty on May 28th for. Good for that. A little more. I guess it's interesting to see prison guards go to prison. But it kind of makes you go, what were you thinking? Taking a stolen gun where you know that the whole story. It's just mind blowing. Also, a couple more interesting gun stories real quick. In Florida, another shooting. Black guy in his driveway, 2 o'clock in the morning, 60-year-old guy. Someone reported that he was stealing the car. It's his car. He reaches in, thinks it's the neighbor saying, hey, reach for the sky. So he turns around. He's got his hands up, and the reports were it's like a firing squad. Bullets were flying everywhere. Evidently, the police shot 7 shots. One of them hit the gentleman. 5 hit the car, and 1 hit the house. Maybe some firing range practice, just a thought. And I saw a report in Philadelphia that this week alone there have been 7 civilians shot, 4 killed, and 6 shootings. 6 of the shootings, suspects were brandishing handguns. The 7th had a knife. And again, for $60,000 a year, no thanks. No thanks at all. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com. Stitcher in your smartphone. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a great night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array.